Okay, well, it's Valentine's Day.
Yep.
It is February 14th, 2005, and I'm Kira Buick with General Anime Hayes. And I said, we could go all the way back and talk about where you grew up and, you know, Allentown, nursing school and that sort of thing, and then go into World War II, and we could. But, and maybe just to start with telling me why you decided to become a nurse in the first place.
Oh, well, I think my mother used to tell me that I would bandage legs of chairs when I was a tiny little girl. And I don't know just why I became a nurse early on. There could be several reasons. I always wanted to help people. I always wanted to care if they were ill. Secondly, it's different. If I'm talking about going into the Army, then I would say it was because I wanted to serve my country. But in the early days, it was during the Depression, and it was very important that I couldn't go to college. We didn't have enough money. And I was trying to decide whether I wanted to be a musician, because I'd always played several instruments and had taken piano lessons for something like 15 years in my life. And when I learned that the Allentown Hospital School of Nursing was giving board and room and board and $5 a month, and you could get a diploma and become a nurse, I thought that was very good. And so I went to the three-year diploma program and enjoyed it, graduated first in my class. And at that time, I finished in February 1941, and the war started in the following December. And from that time on, then I learned there was such a thing as an Army and an Army Nurse Corps. Not too much about the Army Nurse Corps, but I knew there were nurses who served in the Army. And most of us in my hospital school of nursing and wanted to serve our country. And when two doctors from the University of Pennsylvania Hospital Unit came to our hospital asking the first few honor students and the students if they wanted to join the University of Pennsylvania Hospital Unit, I thought about it. Didn't take very long, and I decided this was the unit for me. And these two gentlemen, tremendous physicians, traveled to Allentown, Easton, Reading, all in Pennsylvania units, cities rather, because if they took all of the nurses from the Pennsylvania Hospital, University of Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia, they couldn't take care of their patients. So they had to go out and get a few of us who were not from the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Marion Kennedy, even though she was from my hometown, was from the University of Pennsylvania Hospital unit. And so, as you'll probably read, I became a second lieutenant in the reserve, sworn in a police station in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I had just a week, and I was called to active duty. And during that time, we were, as I said, during the Depression, didn't have much money, but I was earning $65 a month, which was pretty good. The staff nurse, this was in the hospital.
Okay.
And the operating room nurses were earning, I was in the operating room, and we were earning $5 more than the staff nurses down in the wards. And I think our supervisors earned $70 a month. But here I was earning $65 a month. And then when I went into the Army, I earned $70. That was $5 more. You could do an awful lot with $5 in those days. But I joined that unit and had to pay for the transportation to get there and so forth. And I had to, with my mother, and I don't know where we got the $60, but that was what I had to do to get things that I needed into for transportation. And then I went into the Army and by trolley car. That was the cheapest transportation. So it went from, the trolley car went from Allentown, Pennsylvania to Philadelphia, 56 miles by trolley. And then I joined the hospital unit and was with them. And so I think that I became a nurse because I wanted to help people. My mother used to watch me bandage up legs and so forth. And secondly, because of remuneration, I didn't know I was making 65, and I wasn't quite sure what the Army was making, but mm-hmm. I wanted to serve my country. Uh-huh. So that was it.
And once the war started, that was the first you really heard about an Army nurse corps.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what did you think about it, or what did your parents think when you...
Well, my father had died when I was 19. And so I was finished with school at 20 when I wait for the exercises, which by that time I was 21. My mother, of course, it was difficult. At that time, I didn't realize that it was such a short span from when my father died. He died in 39. And so mother was very proud, of course, you know, that I was going to serve my country. My brother was a Marine. So she had two children in the service. And my sister, who was younger, was in high school at that time. And I remembered when I returned from World War II, I saw in the window at home, she had the two stars, the blue stars. That meant she had two children serving her country. So I think she was very proud.
Uh-huh. And you were stationed in India.
I was stationed... Well, I think you can read about it.
The Lido Road.
You can read about all mm-hmm. that. It was very difficult because we were in the most northeastern part of Assam, India, which was at the Burma border and right across from China. So you see, we were in a very isolated area. Mm-hmm. And I always said, in this book and other papers, it was 1,000 miles or so above Calcutta mm-hmm. in the jungle. And but I think as I look at maps today, it looks about 700 or 800 miles. But it was a long distance,
uh-huh. and far enough.
And yeah, and my trip over to is written, and you mm-hmm. can read about it. But it took 42 days to go by ship, and we were chased by submarines, and finally ended up on the west coast of India, and then we had to go back to the east coast because you see we couldn't enter where we wanted to. I could talk forever on that. The thing is, we didn't even know where we were going. We were fitted when I left. We're sort of jumping here. We should say I went from Philadelphia. We spent several months in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Thought we would leave. We were issued woolen uniforms, and we thought we were going to go to Europe with the 101st or the 82nd because they were down there training at the same time. And then I guess it was in December of 42, right, our boots were taken away and some of our heavy clothing. So we didn't know where we were going, and we were issued, I think, just that little brown and white soccer uniform. And eventually we left and went to the west coast of India, I mean of California, and then 42 days by ship. Mm-hmm. And you can read about those experiences. I think I've written them up a couple places. And then when we got to the west coast of India, we had to take about 8 or 9 days on a very narrow gauge railroad going back east again. Because we had wanted, or not I, but that wanted to go up to Rangoon and up to Burma that way, I believe. But of course, Rangoon had just been captured, so we weren't able to go there. Then when we got to near the east coast, then we still had to go way up northeast. And we traveled by even a narrow gauge railroad, if you can imagine that, and then by flatboat for a couple nights, and then by truck, and landed in the mud, and of course we didn't have any boots, and then the worst malaria district of the world in the monsoon weather. So we would pour rain, and then the sun would come out, and it would be mud, and then it would be pouring rain, and so we lived like that 2.5 years in dashes, which were made of bamboo, and our roof made from fronds from palm trees. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very primitive, until we started improving the situation. And we had a very creative commanding general, Dr. Rafton. If you know University of Pennsylvania, it's the hospital is named after Dr. Rafton now in Philadelphia. He found one little private, I guess he was, who wasn't much of a medic, and he put him to raising pigs. And so once a week or so, our patients received good pork. And then later on, he raised chickens, I believe it was, and so we had eggs for the patients. And once in a while, we would get that food. Otherwise, we were on British rations, nothing. Stands, spam, stands, crackers, crackers, crackers for almost 6 months. And finally we got on C rations. At least I think it was C rations. And for the 2.5 years we were there, we had an American hospital and we had a Chinese hospital. So we took care of American patients and Chinese patients. I was in the operating room, just a young second lieutenant.
And it was really your first time away from home?
First time away from home, and so far from home. We were 12,000 miles away from home. But I felt very far away from home when I went to Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
And it took us, the train that left Philadelphia, it took us 2 or 3 days to get to Camp Claiborne. Mm-hmm. Now today, you could go by train quite rapidly or by, you know, flying. It's a couple hours. But in those days, it was much different.
So you were there for 2.5 years.
That's very different than the way
people are deployed and stationed. You know, even later in your career, but even now, you wouldn't think of sending a nurse to the same hospital for 2.5 years.
Well, we went as a unit. And you probably don't know, but every large research hospital in the United States had a unit. John Hopkins had a unit, University of Pennsylvania, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, University of California. Mm-hmm. And those units left and went together and stayed together. Mm-hmm. Some of them went to Europe, some went to, well, all over the world. And so I think there was an advantage in that. We all knew each other. And it's amazing that we were all stuck there in the jungle, and yet there wasn't much discord at all. We were together. We were all serving our country. And and I'm sure the other units were the same way. Mm-hmm. And so there is that advantage. You learn to work together and you're successful, and whatever we had to do, we did it well, I think. Mm-hmm. Where if you have a hospital that's not a hospital, well, yes, today, if they're constantly changing and the personnel is changing, I wonder just how wonderful it works. But we did it in Vietnam and it worked out. We had to. In Korea, it was a little different. But the rotation base wasn't as, it was much less than what it is in Vietnam today or in Iraq. I don't even know. They're over there for a year, I believe. Just about a year. But we signed up for 2.5. We signed up for the duration of the war and 6 months afterwards. Mm-hmm. You were only two.
And then when you came home, and at the end of the war, there were 50,000 nurses to be discharged.
57,000
stayed in.
Well, that happened because let's read about it. But we were at Fort Dix, and some units, when they got to Fort Dix, weren't even considered to be retained. They just said, "Okay, mm-hmm. you're finished. You did your duty. Your duration is 6 months. They're up. You go." Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that when we were coming through Fort Dix, evidently they needed us, and they told us we'd have the option of leaving or staying. And so a few of us decided to stay, not too many, because at that time it was very popular to be an air hostess. You had to be a registered nurse to be an air hostess. Uh-huh. And of course the airplanes and travel, it was all something that was great, paying well, and sort of tugged at your heart. Well, you want to be one that's glamorous. And many of our nurses did that work afterwards. I chose to stay in the Army, which I think was a good idea.
Do you remember what you thought about at that time, you know, trying to decide if you would stay in or leave the Army?
I didn't have, it didn't take me very long to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And once the decision was made, I've always kept to that decision. So I thought probably that the Army hospitals were always going to be like that wonderful unit I was in World War II. We had top professionals from the University of Pennsylvania. And our nurses were very good. They were all, most of our young physicians were residents. And of course, then their chiefs were our chiefs. So we had a tremendous medical staff. And then our nurses were excellent. And I'm sure at that time I thought, this is the way every Army hospital is, you know, with top-notch people. And I think we could still say, I'm probably prejudiced, but nurses in the Army are good nurses. They're devoted to their patients, and they want to give the very best care they can give. So I don't think it took me long to make that decision. I was always going to be that way. And then I had another decision to make shortly thereafter, whether or not it was going to go into the regular Army. See, I was a reserve, which meant I could get out at that time if I just so desired. And so I had to make up my mind whether I wanted to be a regular Army, member of the regular Army, or just stay in the reserves, and I chose to become a regular Army officer. And in those days, one had to go before a board. That isn't done today. You know, if they want to be regular Army, if they meet certain criteria, they're nominated to be that regular Army. But in those days, one had to go before a board. And I was selected. Then the other thing, the United States Army Air, or I should say United States Air Force, was coming into being in 1947. So that was another decision. Should I join the Air Force? I mean, promotions were going to be great. We were given this great big story how wonderful the Air Force was going to be. That was a hard decision. And no, and I decided no, I was to stay in the Army. But they were talking about promotions were going to come so rapidly because it was a small unit just being formed, and it probably was true. No, I decided to stay in the Army Air Corps.
And was that, when you went into the regular Army, was that essentially saying, I'm going to make this a career?
That's right.
That I'm going to be a career.
I'm going to be a career officer.
And at that point, you couldn't be married and be in the Army Air Corps.
That's right.
Right. That's right. So that was another big decision, too.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I was thinking too much about marriage at that time. Had a lot of fun, but very, very athletic. And dance all night, you know, those years, young, like you, and did everything.
Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of decisions to make right when you came home then.
Right. Decided to stay here.
And in the 50s, there was this kind of nationwide nursing shortage as well, where the hospitals are complaining, we don't have enough nurses. Army sort of let too many people out, and then once the Air Force came and the split, that you need to get more people back in, and everybody's trying to recruit nurses. Do you remember much about that?
Or I don't think that's actually quite that.
It wasn't that bad.
True. No, indeed not. Not in the 50s.
Okay.
Not in the 50s. One didn't talk about shortages in the 50s. It wasn't until the 60s, after Korea. I went to Korea. It was in one of the first. There were three units that went into Korea, the Incheon invasion. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I was a captain, and I was in charge of the operating room. And I think I was a captain. But no, there wasn't a shortage until the 60s. That's when the nation, there was a shortage of nurses in the nation. And the Surgeon General, the Public Health, not the Army, but the Public Health Surgeon General, put out that great report. Mm-hmm. About nurses and shortage and so forth. And so since there was a national shortage, then it affected the Army Nurse Corps.
Right.
So that's when in 1963, Colonel Clark, who was the chief, when I was assistant chief, we had various recruiting efforts, Operation Nightingale and a couple other things that we tried to do. And then, of course, when I was chief, we were still short for a while because of Vietnam. And so then we had another recruiting drive, and we were able to take all the nurses. Actually, one never had trouble in the path of recruiting Army nurses. When the nurses knew they were needed, they volunteered. And even though a draft had been prepared, legislation, it was never necessary to use it. Now, there was a draft for male nurses later on, but not in the early 60s.
So when you were assigned to Korea the first time, the war was going on, what did you think about being sent again to another war?
I just thought that was marvelous. I was serving my country again, you see, in war. I never gave it a thought that I wasn't going to go. As a matter of fact, at the time I was here at Fort Myer, working in the hospital in the outpatient or the emergency room in the building which still stands, which is now headquarters, and I pass it often and think I was stationed there in 1950. And I was there waiting to be sent to Columbia University for my baccalaureate. And then the war broke out, and received a telephone call. Would I like to go to Korea? Now, that's strange. We don't do that today. You know, picking up the phone, ask if they want to go to Korea. But we were nearby, and I guess they wanted to have this unit headed by Major Kitty Jung, who was my friend, who was also with me at Fort Myer. And then, of course, they needed the operating supervisor, so they called. But then we were just here a few months. And then, since I didn't get to school then, it was really 7 years later before I was sent to school. But, you know, I was very anxious to serve, you know, do what I had to do to serve my country. Uh-huh. Never gave a second thought that I wouldn't go, or wouldn't want to go.
Uh-huh. Did you think about, I mean, did you feel that you might be in danger, or did any of those thoughts?
No, it always is going to happen to the other person. You know, that's where you live, in wartime. When in Korea, we were there, USS Missouri was out on the water and shelling right over us all the time. Sometimes they came a little short, but they were trying to get into Seoul, chase the North Koreans out. And so it was sure dangerous. When I visited Vietnam, it was dangerous. You know, it's just, but you always have the feeling, well, it's going to happen to somebody else. In World War II, in March of 1944, the Japanese broke through and about 100 miles below us. And had not the Indian troops and the British troops repelled them, all of us up in the jungle, there were about three or four medical units, and those units going into Burma, we would have all been prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. But you don't think about that. You're just working. So, and I'm sure the people in Iraq today are not thinking about themselves as much as giving care to the patients. I haven't talked to any of them. But I would be willing to state unequivocally that Lieutenant Otto, maybe she's a captain now, is not thinking about herself at all, or any hardship that she may have, but rather she's thinking only about taking care of those patients. I just know that's true. It has to be. That's the way I feel.
And that's just sort of how you get by every day.
You don't even think about getting by. You know, you're doing your job. Uh-huh. You're serving your country, and that is so important. That transcends everything else.
And so then you were in Korea, and you came home, and you worked at Walter Reed.
Well, I was in various assignments before then, you know, after when I came home, I worked at Fort Dix, and then Valley Forge, and then Korea, you know, several things are already done. But after Korea, that would have been 1950s or so, I was at Indiantown Gap, and from there I went to Nursing Service Administration's course in Fort Sam Houston. It was about the third or fourth course that was given in nursing administration. Graduated first in that class again. Always very fortunate. And then went back to Walter. And then I was assigned for the first time to Walter Reed in 1954.
And this is when you worked on Ward 8?
it's a funny story, really. Here I thought I was so good, you know, I just graduated, you know, all that, and I thought, when I was interviewed by the chief nurse, she said, well, I think that you could be a head nurse. And, of course, my heart was set on being assistant head nurse, and my heart was set on being a head nurse. But anyway, I was assigned the position I had was head nurse then of the ear, nose, and throat clinic. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of disappointed. I thought, a clinic, you know? You know, here I am. I should be running a ward. And because that's what I did before in 1950s. But anyway, in the 40s, when I was after I got out of the operating room in Fort Dix, I ran a big orthopedic ward. In fact, I still, about 2 months ago, I had a call again from one of my patients. And then I called a couple more of my patients from those days, way back in the 40s. They're still living. Most of them are gone. But anyway, that was the love of my life, I think, my orthopedic patients when I was, let me see, how old was I? I was 46. 26 years of age, 27 years of age, taking care of those patients from Europe. All of them had osteomyelitis, amputees. It was a wonderful people. So here I'm back at Walter Reed many years later, and I'm told, well, I could be the assistant head nurse. But anyway, I was appointed head nurse of the clinic. And that was a great experience because I not only took care of the clinic, but also was the scrub nurse in the operating room for my chief. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have that now. The nurses assigned the operating room to all the surgeries. But in those days, one nurse did a particular type of surgery and went to the operating room with her chief. Mm-hmm. So that was a very good experience for me. So I enjoyed it in the end. And then, of course, from there, I went down to the emergency room and was head nurse in the emergency room. And it was when I was in the emergency room that the chief nurse came over and got me to be the first nurse to take care of President Eisenhower. And we didn't know what was wrong with him, but so we had to prepare for anything. And it was quite an experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Took care of him for almost a month.
You were 26, 27?
At that time, no, I was older. I was 26, 27 when I was at Fort Dix. But then after that, I'd gone to Korea and come back. That was 56, so I was 36 years of age.
And you're taking care of the president.
Yep. Telling them it was a tremendous experience. Yeah, a lot of stories. I think you'll meet a couple mm-hmm. in there. I didn't get too many in that book. Mm-hmm. But because that's between us. Uh-huh. But he was a marvelous patient. Very thoughtful, very sensitive. Mm-hmm. Tremendous experience for me as a youngster. Mm-hmm. As a 36, you're still very young.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever think in your wildest dreams that as an Army nurse, you're caring for the president of all people?
No, never. It's unbelievable. And for instance, Sherman Adams, you don't know who he is, of course, but he was assistant to the president. And he would come up to the hospital and bring these bills, legislation, for the president to sign. And he would give one to the president to sign. And then the president, and I would take it from the president, put it on the dresser. You know, when I think of it, you know, it's just amazing for a little old me. And but that dresser now, that whole area, I had a committee at Walter Reed. This is a side. But I had a committee, and we started in 96, to restore the area that we had at Ward 8. Into the new hospital. Mm-hmm. And so we found all the furnishings that were used for the president. I was able to identify them. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we found one of the beds that was Mamie's bed, because she slept in a room next to the president, in the basement of the commanding officer's house at Walter Reed in 1996, many years later. But that, yes, I have that committee, and on that committee are doctors and nurses. Jan Sosby is on that committee. Mm-hmm. We worked hard to get it back. It's beautiful now. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous.
And was this just a general ward where any president would have come, or was it specifically for President Eisenhower?
Well, in Walter Reed, as in Bethesda, there is a unit, would be called the VIP unit, and that's where the generals, 3 and 4 stars, go for their medical care. When they're patients, that's where they're assigned. But in the back of that unit at Walter Reed is closed off, mm-hmm. and it has its own separate elevator and so forth, so that security can be maintained. And in that unit, there's a huge reception area, and then there's an area that's aside for the rooms. Mm-hmm. There would be the president's room, a little sitting room, an outside porch, and then a room for the president's wife. Mm-hmm. It's called First Lady's Room. And then we have a huge dining room. We worked hard to do that. But that's a side.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting.
But it's interesting that we've had these opportunities, that uh-huh. I've had the opportunities. Uh-huh. Very, very fortunate.
And then in 60 and 61, you went back to Korea?
Well, I went back to Korea. Yeah, I was on orders to go to Europe. Mm-hmm. And my mother was very ill. And I knew she wasn't going to last for 2 years. That was the tour. No, it was 3 years, I guess, the tour. And so I asked if I could be sent to Korea. Well, they didn't want to send me back there because, you know, after all that, it was not a desirable tour, mm-hmm. but it was a 1-year tour. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to Korea, and I was chief nurse of the 11th of that hospital. It wasn't a very large hospital, but we were busy. Mm-hmm. And then we were extended to 16 months because of the Cuban crisis. So even though people, it's just like today, now you hear about these people being extended in Iraq. Well, it's happened all along in our armies. You never know what's going to happen. So it was supposed to be a one-year tour, but it turned out to be 16 months. Now, at that time, I was married, and even though I'd been married in 1956, right after I'd taken care of the president, I really hadn't spent much time with my husband because I was going to school in Columbia, the university, and then I was assigned to Europe, to Korea, and we thought it would only be a year, and it would be 16 months. So yes or no, it's going to happen.
That must have been tough as a newlywed too.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah.
To Korea.
Yeah.
And so you had several overseas tours as well, not just being lived, you know, from California or to Texas.
Right. So I had China, Burma, India, and I had Korea, or, and then I had Korea again. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I was chief, I went around the world.
Right.
So I thought, you know, that's usual. But, so I had three overseas tours during the war.
That's a lot.
It is.
It seems.
I thought there was no other chief that's had those tours, three tours in the war.
And did you like traveling overseas? Do you like that?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Yeah. Different. Didn't take, I was always work-oriented, you know. Some members of our unit say when I was stationed in Japan, after Korea, I went to Japan, on their days off, you know, visited this place and that place. Well, we were so busy. I didn't. I didn't go any place. I still saw things later on when I was chief, assistant chief. Europe, Asia.
And so then you come home and, let's see, you went to the U.S. Management School. Or
yeah, 1962. Yeah, and we were Colonel Jensen, who was the assistant chief of Walter Reed at that time, and I were the first two nurses to be sent to any school that was outside of the medical arena. Mm-hmm. And you see, at that time, well, now I'm going a little bit ahead of myself. Later on, when I was assistant chief, and particularly when I was chief, we validated positions, you see, in the schools, such as you've read about in the, for instance, Connie went to the Army War College. Well, it was during my time as chief that we sent the first nurse to the Army War College, and then validated positions so they could go to the Army War College, and all worked so hard to validate positions so that our nurses could get their doctorates and their masters and so forth. But in my time, so that was the first that they had done for nurses. They had sent the two of us, they meaning the Surgeon General's office, had sent the two of us to the management school. It was a short course, but it was good.
What kinds of things did you learn?
Well, organization, management, supplies, equipment, personnel. Didn't have any exams. I like that.
That's good. But you seem to have done well on exams so far.
Yeah, like that.
And what did you think when they selected you to go to this school?
I don't think I thought it was going to be an exciting experience. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And by that time, let me see, that would have been 62, I was 42 years of age. I was a major, so I was very young to be sent to that school. Colonel Johnson, I mean Jensen was sent, she was a lieutenant colonel. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between a major and a lieutenant colonel. And that school was for lieutenant colonels, so that I remember I couldn't figure out why I was selected. Mm-hmm. Then when I was there, I was called down to the office one day, and in front of all those people who were really my strangers, you know, strangers to me, I didn't know them, I was promoted to lieutenant colonel. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there very long when that happened. Mm-hmm. So evidently the powers who sent me knew I was going to be a lieutenant colonel. See, in those days, one didn't know when they were going to be promoted. Mm-hmm. Today, one knows exactly when they're put on a list, whether they, it's so different. Uh-huh. And they know exactly, but not exact date when they're going to be promoted, but they when they're put on the list, but they know it's coming.
Right.
And they call it promotable. So, for instance, my doctor at orthopedics is a lieutenant colonel with a P in back of his name, which means he's on the list for promotion, uh-huh. but he's not promoted yet.
Okay.
But we didn't even have such a list. So, therefore, my family never attended any of my promotions, my mother, my brother, my brother and my sister, until I became a general officer. And I knew. And that was only a short time before I was promoted. Did I know I was going to be promoted?
So you were promoted to lieutenant colonel, and so you, throughout
well,
this
at
whole
school.
Time, you're advancing pretty far into the
into the administrative duties, mm-hmm. increasing responsibilities. Right.
And there were limits on how far someone in the Army Nurse Corps could go at that point, right? I mean, that those sorts of laws that allowed.
But we, if you were lieutenant colonel, you could stay. Well, there was no law.
That hadn't happened yet.
No, not in those times. But we knew that if perchance, at lieutenant colonel, you could stay in for 28 years. And even though you wanted to stay for 30, if you were a lieutenant colonel, there was no space because we only had five colonels. Everybody really had to get out when they were lieutenant colonels. And I remember seeing some of my supervisors, you see, almost in tears because they had to get out of the Army after 28 years. But then, of course, legislation changed. Over the years, legislation was being changed so that you could stay in for 30 years. And by that time, you'd be a lieutenant colonel, but you could stay in for 30 years. Then legislation changed. There would be more opportunities for to become a colonel. And during my time, spells out here, I couldn't remember them, but how many colonels we had, and when I finished my tour, or my when I was assistant chief, what we had, and when I was chief, what we had. And it's amazing, from five colonels all those years, we only had one colonel during World War II, and five colonels at the time that we're talking about, in the 60s, to the numbers that we had, it's almost miraculous that happened. Now, when I see these nurses at Walter Reed, there's so many of them full colonels, and they don't realize the struggles that we had, first to validate positions, to keep those nurses who were promoted, not just in administrative positions, but in education and research, and also, at the most importantly, at the care, for the care of the patient at the bedside. Not directly at the bedside, but in the supervisory capacity. So, and those, that's just the evolution of nursing in the military. And then right prior to, this is skipping a bit, but then prior to my retirement, we started the nurse clinician program. And that was started at Walter Reed with one pediatric nurse and then an obstetrical nurse down at Fort Knox. And then after we started working on it during my time, then after I retired, it was brought into a regulation. So we have nurse clinicians. Do you know what I'm talking about? The highest preparing okay. So we went from having one colonel to having many colonels, sending them to school to be prepared, sending them to educational programs, being prepared to do nursing research. Such a tremendous transition that occurred. I think that one of the primary reasons is that we had a surgeon general who recognized the value of Army nurses during my time, very much so, and appreciated everything they did. And also, then when I became chief, as you'll read, we started, well, when assistant chief, excuse me, was during Colonel Clark's time, my predecessor, that we started the Walter Reed Army School of Nursing, the Walter Reed Army Institute of Nursing. And that was one of the vehicles through which we recruited nurses, which was
what
a tremendous program.
What were you up against? I mean, before you know, the ranks, before they expanded the numbers, colonels, for instance, what were you up against, or how did you have to validate? You say you have to validate these positions.
Well,
today it seems obvious.
It does, but you see, in those days, it didn't seem obvious. You see, so if you had there are only so many spaces for the total Army, mm-hmm. in general officers and captains and in lieutenants and colonels, majors, and so forth. And the male population, you know, course, had all those positions. And the females came into the picture, and we weren't truly commissioned officers at the beginning. We were in a quasi-status. And so we had to become professionalized, recognized as professional nurses. And we did that through education. So as my own experience exemplifies that. I was graduate of diploma program. I went on and got my bachelor's and my master's through the auspices of the Army. The Army sent me. I didn't pay for that. I paid for my everything, you see. And as we prepared the nurses to be and to hold these responsible positions, they were recognized that they could do the job. And then, of course, the Army then over the years gave us more spaces as colonels and as lieutenant colonels, majors.
Do you think that was sort of the Army accepting the women as well?
As well. I would say as well. Well, at that time, yes. And not until 55 did we have a male nurse. Mm-hmm. And then that was legislation was passed. No, it was just reserves then in 55. And they came in gradually, you see. And then it was during my time, I guess, that we were the regular Army. But the first reserve male nurse was in 55. And I think it was recognition, too, of the ability of our... They knew that we were giving our very best that we could, the best care that we could for the patients. And we were just being recognized as commissioned officers. And that's why we worked so hard during the years, my predecessors, to have the entire Corps be graduates, at least, of the baccalaureate degree program, which then came about. We almost made it in my time, and I think it came about in my successor's time that we reached 100%. And I think here I mentioned what percentage we reached, and I can't remember offhand. But my predecessors worked hard. We each increased spaces, increased numbers in a certain grades. When I was, I think when Colonel Clark was chief, and then our assistant, yeah, when she was chief and I was assistant, we had a triangle. The triangle should be a few colonels, lieutenant colonels, you know, coming down. The base should be first lieutenants and second lieutenants. It was just there, upside down. Eventually, we had then more majors and lieutenant colonels, eventually, in my time, than we did first and second lieutenants. So then we were able to work very hard and recruit in the first and second lieutenants, and we got back to a stable triangle again. I don't know how it is now. I would imagine, I hope, that they kept that, because you need that young blood coming in to staff, and because you don't want to be top-heavy in majors and lieutenant colonels. Well, I don't think they could now, because there's such an establishment. I'm sure that there are X number of colonels and X number of lieutenant colonels and so forth. And now, with recent legislation, the chief of the Army Nurse Corps is 2 stars.
Oh, that's right. In the last year, even.
Yeah. See, in my time, when I was promoted, there was no legislation. There was legislation which removed the restrictions, but there was no legislation that said there shall be a 1-star chief of the Army Nurse Corps, or a Brigadier General of the Army Nurse Corps. So all that has changed, little by little.
And during this period, more and more male nurses are coming into the Corps.
Yeah.
What do you think that was like for them to come into a field that... Historically, people associate nursing.
That's right. They did. And when I was chief, 2% of all nurses in the country were men. Mm-hmm. And at that time, if I remember correctly, we had about 12%, 7-12% of our corps, male nurses. And then during Vietnam, I know that I said that we had at least 27% of our nurses in Vietnam were men. And I felt that was very good because they could get up into the forward units. They were, for the first time we ever had nurses in forward units, such as 173rd Airborne and so forth.
Why wouldn't they have assigned women, the female nurses, to those positions? I mean, I know the laws about women in combat.
Well, that's parachuting. Mm-hmm. We didn't have women doing parachuting.
So these male nurses were parachuting.
They would go in with their units, or go wherever they had to go, And then, yeah, we just...
Did they have to have weapons with them at that point?
Oh, yeah.
Because they were new
Yeah.
And you couldn't get at that point.
Well, I was never really in favor of a nurse carrying a weapon anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But it was nice to have protection, someone around. For instance, when we were in Korea, none of us had weapons, but we were surrounded by the first Marines, mm-hmm. you see, so we felt safe. Up in World War II, I can't remember specifically. I think the men, yes, the physicians had medical, you know, they had their little side gun, but we didn't have anything. I don't know if we felt safe or not.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we worried too much about our safety. Because we were so isolated and in the jungle, I guess we thought nobody would come. But there again, I told you, in 44, we could have been captured.
Yeah.
So you just never know. Yeah. But now the whole situation has changed. As you know, females, I hate to use the word females, but, you know, females, are they do everything. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they're still not allowed in combat. Mm-hmm. But nurses have always been in combat areas. We've always been subjected to that. If you have a copy of the... highlights, you'll, and I'm sure you have or have seen them, you know, how many nurses we lost in World War I and World War II, so 201, it's, you know, in Korea, we didn't lose any nurses in Korea. However, we lost the chief nurse who was assigned to Korea. She was on an airplane going from Japan to Korea. The ship went down, I mean, the plane was crashed. We lost that chief nurse. But they don't consider that Korean casualty because she had not yet got to Korea,
yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
So we didn't lose any nurses in Korea. Uh-huh. And in Vietnam, we lost, 8 or 9 mm-hmm. nurses. And, yes, and I was chief nurse when we lost all of those.
Mm-hmm. So the rationale for those male nurses in the forward units, or Lake Yap, the 71st in Lake Yap at one point, they thought that it was going to be attacked, so they moved...
171st, wasn't it?
One of those. They moved out all of the female nurses and staff, and it was just males there. Is that because of the weapons?
Where did you read that? Because I've heard
Sarnacki's, that. Sarnacki's, I
think. But I don't know where she got that, because, you know, maybe they did, maybe for a very, very short period of time.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
But we did not do it. I was chief then, you see, with the 171st in Lake Coop. But they could have done it just... Maybe it just happened because at the time we were rotating more females than whatever. But it could have been done by the hospital commanders. Mm-hmm. You see, they saw the situation and did so. And if she has in her book, which I've never read, because when I read about Vietnam, I knew one of the early parts before it was published, there were so many errors. And I, you know, was about 2 hours on tape correcting at that time, and I don't got to read the finished project. But anyway, it could have happened, yes. Mm-hmm. And if it's in her book, then it didn't happen.
And it's
but that's not the, as far as I was concerned, that was the primary reason. Mm-hmm. Male nurses, we wanted a lot of male nurses, because did you ever lift a heavy patient or someone who's injured? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the men could do it much more easily sometimes than a female. And so... I think that was up to the local chief nurse. We had a chief nurse in Vietnam. And if she saw the situation needed more male nurses, she could easily transfer from one hospital to the next. Uh-huh. So that, if it were done, it was done on the local level. It didn't come up to us.
Uh-huh. That was all done by the chief nurse?
There. By the chief nurse in Vietnam. Uh-huh. We would kept informed, uh-huh. you see, or maybe we had suggestions. Uh-huh. And particularly, that was my reason of visiting 3 times, uh-huh. to see what was going on. I remember the first time I went over there, there wasn't a physical therapist to be seen. And, you know, physical therapists are needed. And not 2 months later. Mm-hmm. So, and even though that was out of my arena, uh-huh. that was one of the suggestions I made. I can remember that. And then after that, there were many physical therapists assigned in all wards. But my concern was about the care of the patient. And so I would see just exactly how they were doing things, what they needed, how we could help them. Always a very nice thing to do, I think. What do you need?
Yeah.
And then you'd be sure to help them with their needs.
Yeah.
Because they never asked for things that they didn't need. They never asked for things they might want. It was what they needed. So that's what they did. But the chief nurse of Vietnam, you're talking about Vietnam, had that authority, you see, within the unit, after approval from her superiors.
So when you were assistant chief nurse, then when the build-up for Vietnam sort of starts?
Well, the build-up didn't really occur until, it was in 65, yes, I was assistant chief. And I remember, we had one hospital, and I remember the Secretary of Defense was Robert McNamara, and the Surgeon General had gone over to a briefing, and he said to them, well, we have to build, they're going to have 25 hospitals. Well, he came back and told us, his staff, the doctors, nurses, dentists, you know, the chiefs. And we just sort of, Secretary of Defense, he's out of his mind, you know? That's impossible. Well, it was true, because I think it was on my second visit, we had 25 hospitals. Yes, it would have been my second visit, because it was about 68. We had 25 active hospitals, and then, of course, we had the men in the forward units, and we had battalion aid stations and so forth all over, but hospitals, evac hospitals, NASH, so forth. So we were really, really busy.
And so recruitment had really started even before the troop buildup starts.
Well, in 1963 is when Colonel Clark, I was assistant chief, put out a recruiting effort. We called it the Nightingale, the project.
Operation Nightingale.
Operation Nightingale, is what we called it. And so we recruited all these nurses. And this will explain numbers. I didn't, when I glanced at it yesterday, I was pretty smart to remember all those numbers then. But now I couldn't. I really can't. Yes, so then we, our quotas went up. I think when I was chief, we needed 8,243. I remember that number. And then that was our objective. That was what we needed overall. And all throughout the world. And then it was brought down a bit. And then in those days, there was no ROTC. You read about the reserve nurses. We didn't have that program. That came about, I think it was in General Park's time or General Sawitsky's time, much later. So we didn't have reserve nurses. We had reserve units that belonged, say, to the University of Washington Hospital or whatever. So we had reserve units, Pennsylvania National Guard or whatever. But we didn't have... I didn't have the ROTC program at all.
So there's not this ready group of nurses that you could just call up and say, you're activated.
Well, yes. They were part of a group. They were part of a unit. We could do that.
Okay.
And we did it.
The,
we had many reserve
the
units.
The 805th Hospital?
The 8055?
Yeah,
no, there was one from Washington. It was the reserve unit. And that was one unit that was that contributed a great deal in Vietnam. And I don't remember its designation. I don't think it was the 85th, though. Pretty sure not. But it's hard to remember all those designations now. I did know them, of course.
It's hard to learn them as well.
But now, you see, with the ROTC units, the nurses, the individual is going to school, she's going into a nursing program, can join the ROTC, and then she gets remuneration, and I guess that's quite a lot, and holds a first lieutenant, I believe, these days. I'm not sure. But we didn't have that program. However, say the Pennsylvania National Guard or Pennsylvania Reserve units, say in my hometown, they didn't have a hospital unit attached to them, but some did, so that's how that University of yes, it was the University of Washington. Washington State, I'm talking about. And that unit went over to Vietnam, and there were a couple others, too.
And so with Operation Nightingale, there were all these ways to recruit nurses in the rain for Walter Reed Army's.
Well, we had various programs. We started, the Army Student Nurse programs were started before Colonel Clark's time, but she was a great one for recruiting, because when she was a young officer, she was a recruit herself. And so she would come up with all these wonderful ideas, very creative, and I think I copied her in a way, but then I would have to do all the work, you see, because she was out. She was Mr. Outside, Mrs. Outside. I was inside when I was assistant chief. That's where it has to be. When I was chief, I was out, you see, and my assistants, that time though, instead of just one assistant, I had two assistants, and then we had a big office. We had 21 nurses assigned then at that time at the Surgeon General's office, all put them into all various areas where they could get into areas that we had never been into before. But so we had the registered nurse program, and then we had the backup group programs, and then we decided, Colonel Clark decided she would like, well, it wasn't her decision really, Colonel Harper, who was her predecessor, General Heaton decided, he was our Surgeon General, he decided he wanted to have a three-year program. And of course, that time, the four-year programs were just coming up. We knew that was going to be the future. We surely didn't want to have a three-year program.
Right.
And so Colonel Harper formed a committee. I was just a junior officer then working at Walter Reed, but I knew all about this. And they came up with a four-year program, and he agreed. So by the time Colonel Clark came in as chief, she just ran with it. And the University of Maryland, I remember the tears we had and the struggles, but we got the program through because we didn't know whether we were at the University of Maryland or University of Wisconsin or what. And then it was decided University of Maryland, affiliated with the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, which was a great clinical center. And those nurses, I must say, who graduated from that program, were tremendous nurses and officers. A little different from the person who had not been exposed to the military. So that program, unfortunately, was closed due to money, lack of money after I retired. I wish it would have been kept open. And now they're trying to get another program, you see, started again. And they kept the other one, but, you know, Congress does funny things sometimes. So the program, if they would have kept the one that we had during World War One time, we wouldn't have had the heartaches at World War II time, you see, or a time later on. But wisdom is a beautiful thing. It's not always there. It's missing sometimes.
And how was, I'm trying to figure this out.
So let's go back a minute for the recruiting.
Okay.
We had our Operation Nightingale in 1963, and then, of course, as you'll read, I had We also then went out for nurses when I became chief. So when I was assistant chief and chief, we recruited a lot of nurses, and we had, as you probably know, a huge recruiting program. We started with just a few nurses in recruiting, and we ended up, I think, 30 to 40 of them out in the field in my time. But that was gradual, you see. And we had the student nurse programs, which were graduate, undergraduate programs. And then we had the Army, the RAIN program, the Walter Reed Army School of Nursing. From those programs, we recruited so many people. Then there was one other, the nurses could come, of course, in directly, which they did.
And how was all of this, the recruiting organized?
Well, at first, and with Colonel Clark, we had it. See, in the old days, everything came under the Chief of Corps that pertained to nursing. Now half of that today, and it doesn't matter to you right now, but it's down in San Antonio and to the Army Medical Service Command. But we were responsible for everything in those days. And during Colonel Clark's time, at the beginning of mine, the recruiting, the nurses were then assigned to the Army Recruiting Command because they had the staff. They had the officers, the enlisted people, who were out recruiting for the Army. And then our nurses became an integral part of that unit. So we started off, I can't remember, but I think at Colonel Clark's time, we may have had 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, you know, a very limited number. And then we increased it, and then by the time I became chief, maybe my second year, we had about 31, I think. And then we went up as high as 40. So we had nurses going out into, not only into colleges, but into high school. As much as we could to encourage people to become nurses, but not as many. They concentrated mostly on the collegiate programs.
And that was
organized. And also, not only just those programs, but they were in the stationed with the Army recruiter in the recruiting office, wherever it was, New York City. Or
it was already organized.
It was already organized, but then we added the nurses to it.
Okay, and is that USAREF, U.S. Army Recruiting Command?
Command, that's correct. And it was at Fort Monroe at that time.
Okay, now, what is the difference? This is where I get confused with these military anachronisms that I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand it myself now.
USAREC, and there is U.S. CONARC.
Oh, CONARC.
Continental Army
All right.
Recruiting Command.
Okay. Now, the United States Army CONARC was Continental Army Command. That person was responsible for all the training and the forces within the United States.
Okay.
Under him came one unit that you were referring to was USAREC, which is United States Army Recruiting Command.
Okay.
That was just one of his responsibilities.
Okay. So
now it's much changed, but in those days, that's how it was.
Okay.
So the person who was responsible was Colonel or General Woolnough, and I mentioned him in this thing, recruiting. And he was pro nurses. You see, he knew the value of nurses, and he was a good friend of General Heath, their Surgeon General. So that helped. But we were able to get all those nurses into the command, and working with his male officers and enlisted people. So my nurse, or I shouldn't say my nurse, but she did belong to me, but the recruiting nurse would go to the unit with the sergeant, and he would do some of the scrub work or whatever, you know, so that the nurse could talk directly to the nursing students. And then she would also be there in the office so that when nurses would see the recruiting in the Army Journal Nursing, they would say, go to the recruiting office. That nurse would make an appointment and would go out to that nurse, and if the nurse and if she couldn't go out, then the nurse would come into that office. So we used all the personnel, supplies, equipment, and everything from the recruiting command. But in the early days, we did not have that facility at our command. We had a few nurses that went out under the Surgeon General. But it was taken, we wanted it to be taken away from the Surgeon General because we didn't have the organization in which we could recruit in the manner in which we had to recruit. So
and all
we
that
got
was
transferred
changed.
In the 60s.
62 or 63.
Well, it was, I'm not sure the exact date.
Okay.
Marion Kennedy, then in my time, or was it Colonel Hart? So it was in the 60s that we had signed a nurse that was Marion Kennedy as a lieutenant colonel. We assigned the nurse to the Pentagon, and so that she would be our contact. And she, in effect, then working for DESPER, which is Department, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel.
Okay, that's another word.
Yeah, DESPER. Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel. And then in that unit, or in that office, Colonel Kennedy then would be over USAREC, really, the nurses. See, they would they would go from, say, that we had a chief nurse at USAREC for the chief recruiter, nurse recruiter. And then she would be under Marion Kennedy, who was our representative, and the deputy chief of staff's personnel. And they, that was in the big recruiting office in the deputy chief of staff.
Okay.
So then it went down to the areas. And in those times we had, what were the six areas? We had one New York State, Northeastern was our first army, second army was a little bit lower, third army was down south, fourth army was Fort Sam Houston, fifth army was up in Chicago, sixth army was out in California. And each one of those armies had their own recruiting office and command.
Okay.
But USAREC was above all of those. So if they would have a conference, it would be USAREC calling the conference together of all those commands who had their own little recruiting office and nurse. And then they would, this then would go up to Washington here from Fort Monroe, where Colonel Clark, I mean Colonel Kennedy was. and then she would work with us. So that when they would have to decide over in the Pentagon at Colonel Kennedy's level, who was going to do all the recruiting, who was going to do all the advertising, they would have to approve it over there. But they would come to us as chief and assistant chief, whichever what I was, I can't remember. And we would sit in the office and decide which ones we wanted of what they presented to us, the different posters and so forth.
Okay.
And that would go down, and sometimes it would come up to us. You know, they would give the recruiting men would give Colonel Kennedy over in Desper suggestions, and then of course it would be approved. It had to be approved at Army level. You know what I'm talking about when I say Army level? See, it meant the top of the Army level. Chief of staff. It never really went up to him because that's why he had deputy chiefs of staff. One for personnel, one for logistics, you see.
Okay, so at the top we have U.S. Commer, which is over
the Army's up here.
Okay.
And underneath that is Desper.
Okay.
And then you would have CONARC.
Okay.
See?
And
under CONARC would be USAREC.
And then all
would be six armies.
Okay.
At that time. All changed.
That's all I needed.
All changed now, you see.
Okay.
So here, so you can sort of remember, would be sitting Lieutenant Colonel. And then later Colonel. But at that time, I think she was Lieutenant Colonel Kennedy. So you sort of put figures in your mind. And then at CONARC, we had Doris Cobb. That would be a wonderful person to talk with. She was not in Vietnam, but she was one of our first nurses at CONARC, if not the first. I think I assigned her. She was the first nurse. She's down in San Antonio.
I think I met her at the Anchor.
Yeah, she's very active in Anchor. So, if you ever get to Anchor, you know, quite finished talk with her, she'd be a tremendous person for you to talk with as far as CONARC is concerned. I think she's the one that set it all up for us.
Okay.
Not CONARC. Down here in USAREC.
Okay.
Under CONARC. You know, that was the big headquarters. So this would be CONARC. And at Fort Monroe, I don't know where it is now. I think it may be out in USAREC headquarters. Maybe out at Fort Benjamin Harrison or something. It was moved out there at one time. But in those days, if you're talking about Vietnam,
then it was at
and
Fort
that's
Monroe.
Your period. It was at Fort Monroe.
Okay. And U.S. CONARC was
Everything was in that area.
And everything. So from USAREC up, it's basically going to be in the D.C. area at that time.
From
U.S.
After
CONARC
that,
and D.C.
CONARC is down in Monroe.
Okay. So these two are in the same place. USAREC.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So in terms of the specific recruitment, Colonel Kennedy was sort of right underneath you at this point.
Well, she was underneath the deputy chief of staff.
Right.
But as far as nursing is concerned, yes. You know, I wish you'd give her a call.
I need to call her again. So we talked
You know, I know it was Monroe, but there, you know, Monroe is, if you know that area down there, you know, there's a lot of water and little islands. And so there was, you know, we always talk about Monroe. But let me give you, do you have her telephone number?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
You know,
we
give her a buzz.
I need to call her.
Yeah.
Again.
And ask her when she was in USAREC, not in USAREC, but up here in the Army at Desper, what were her relations with CONARC and USAREC to CONARC? Because she can even, that was her. That was her work, you see. Mine was overall.
Yeah,
I had
everything.
Right. From clothing, uniform, just everything. But now it's different. Yeah, I sat on the Army board, you know, determining what uniforms. A lot of that is in here. I was amazed to know that it was in this thing. Because being the first one, the nurse who asked me these questions said she only had a couple of weeks to get this out. I remember
it's a lot.
Definitely. Yeah, she had to get it out by the time she was finished with her course.
And so with recruiting, you had to come up with all of these new advertisements.
Right.
You can't just use the same advertisements.
Well, you know, it's been, we had this air. Is that what that was? you mentioned it's
Ayer.
Ayer. We had the entire time when I was assistant chief or chief, I know. But I can't tell you when that company no longer had the...
And they were there with the Army in general for a while. I read somewhere they're the ones that came up with a couple of size, the Be All You Can Be.
Were
Army
they still there?
In the
80s. Were they still there? Well, they may have been out for a while and back again.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? You know, I would think so. Because
uh-huh.
my time's in the 60s, mm-hmm. 20 years.
Yeah. And so NWAer would be like an advertising company that
it
would come
from,
up
yeah,
with
from
the
New York. And Marion knows the detail on that.
Okay.
She worked with it directly.
So it's, see, I have some of these. Ads and things. You looked through the ones from the American Journal of Nursing. Do you remember any of these? Did any of these look
well,
familiar?
Well, I glanced at them. Of course, I saw them all, you know. Remember this one?
The one of the guys laying in bed. Yeah, I always wonder when I look at these, is she an Army nurse? Is she a model? Is she, yes, is that picture taken in
Army hospital?
Is that, you know?
Yeah, I wonder, well, Marion can tell you stuff like that, but... I would say this is a model.
Uh-huh.
Reason?
Uh-huh.
This hat is not right. See, it should be tilted here. It should start here.
Uh-huh.
Not forward like that. See?
Okay.
It should start there and go back.
Uh-huh.
And you see, here it is on the top of the head.
Uh-huh.
See? But we wouldn't quibble on that because they wanted to show the cap.
Right.
Now they don't wear caps, which irritates
right.
me no end. Neither do they wear whites much.
Uh-huh.
They wear fatigues, which also irritates me. It's good I'm not cheap.
And this one says, ask an Army nurse about patriotism.
Uh-huh.
And in Vietnam, that's completely different than it had been in World War II or something else. So I always wonder, you know, who or how was that text developed? You know, did somebody sit down? Did Marion Kennedy? Or did the advertising company?
Well, I think the advertising company sat down and did it.
And did it.
And then sent it to Marion. And she worked with them, yes, no, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then it would go over to us. And some of them, not all of them did, I'm sure. But we were, I can remember them sitting in the office, though, discussing things. So,
uh-huh.
in other words, we wanted to relate to them what we wanted.
Right.
Then they had to come up with whatever we wanted.
Right.
Now, we didn't say, well, have a nurse now with a cap on such and such a place.
Mm-hmm.
And do this poem or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But we said, we want an advertisement that's going to stress patriotism. Mm-hmm. This sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then Marion, I think, worked with them on the write-up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then it's interesting, too, like this one that says you're needed, a nurse is urgently needed. They're pictures of wounded. They're not pictures of a nurse on duty. It just kind of showed you what your job is going to be, I guess. And a lot of them, it doesn't even show a nurse. Yeah, there's the one, the earlier one.
How can you tell me that isn't a male nurse?
Well, see, that's what I wonder. Is that a male nurse? Is he just a soldier?
Yeah. I would think it's, it would either have to be a male nurse or would it have to be a medic.
A medic.
You see.
And if he's a male nurse, he would have had to have been one of those in those forward units that you mentioned earlier.
If he'd been
a male nurse, would he have been in one of those forward units?
Well, if he'd been a male nurse in a hospital, he wouldn't be going out after a wounded patient.
Right, right.
Yeah, he would have to be in a medical unit, mm-hmm. a battalion or first aid station,
uh-huh.
you see, or with the 173rd. Or most of them would have been with medical aid stations.
Mm-hmm.
See,
okay.
Way forward. I don't remember this one at all.
There's two of this, what the Army bring out the specialists, there's one that's this OR nurse, and then there's one of a nurse, and that's
There it is.
You see more emphasis on specialization.
Right, because we need it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're always, you are. But it seems even today the Army is short of nurse anesthetists and orthopedic surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, because in war, those are the two specialties that are really busy. In Vietnam, in World War II, we had all those casualties who were fighting in Burma. And they would come back with all sorts of wounds. I'm talking about now where I was in World War II. And if they weren't wounded in from direct hostile fire, they were trying to build that little road through Burma to China, through the jungle, and there'd be all sorts of accidents because the mud was about this big. And they'd slide down the mountainside. It was horrendous. So we were always needing orthopedic surgeons. And so this was, at that time, we needed a nurse anesthetist. The Army really led, as you probably have read, in preparation for anesthesiologists, nurse anesthetist. An anesthesiologist is a physician. That's the difference. Yeah, Army nurse, of course, too. And of course, we did. We had lots of programs to prepare. We started the first, in my time, with University of Hawaii, preparing nurses at the master's level. So,
Most hospital, a little different than the MASH?
No, you're confusing me now. MASH is the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital that we had before we had the MASH unit.
Right.
And it was during my time, I guess, as assistant chief, I worked with Pat Murphy, you know, in the office, working on the MUST unit. Mm-hmm. So when I became chief, the MUST unit was, in effect, ready to go, and we had the MUST units over in Vietnam, the forward units. It's tremendous when you think about it. And when I see the pictures, is that they don't show too many pictures on TV, but I don't watch TV that much, but I look. I want to see what the equipment they have. Mm-hmm. And I am amazed that how wonderful it is. They have things that we didn't have, you see. Mm-hmm. We had, in World War II, we had no blood where I was. Mm-hmm. See, we were 12,000 miles away at the end of the line. Mm-hmm. By the time some of the X-ray material, the film would reach us, it would be moldy and not able to be used.
Yeah.
See, and then finally, we had no blood. Then we would send people, one of the nurses would go along in a truck. We'd go up the road, the Lego Road, and take blood from soldiers, you know, so we'd have some blood. We had plasma, but then we didn't have any bottles, you know, so we had to improvise to find bottles. And then the bottles we found were narrow neck, you see, and then, but World War II changed so much after, you know, from the World War II to Korea, so many changes were made. And over in Korea, we had, and in here I mentioned the difference in the death rate. You know, that how each was 4% to 2.1%, and then just practically 1%. From those three wars, it was just incredulous. The different instruments in the operating room alone. The preparation of the surgeons, you know, how well prepared they were in Vietnam. And in Korea, I remember we were so short of doctors, we had to use dentists as doctors. We were so busy. And people forget how busy Korea was. That was the worst war, I think, that I was in. So cold. Now, I don't remember this at all. Yeah.
You see a lot of things about education. Get your education.
But it was true. It was wonderful. And I meet people now who say they were in the Army Student Program. Mm-hmm. And some of our nurses who just retired as colonel were graduates of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Nursing. Uh-huh. See how they progressed? It took them 20-some years, but...
This ad, actually, I assume he's a male nursing student. He's not just hanging out with the girls,
That's
probably.
Right. That's right.
She is the only African-American in any ad that I've found.
Well, you know, in those days, you've got to recognize they were not using many blacks in the nursing. Not just the Army.
Right, right.
It was throughout the country, you know.
Right, yeah.
So to have one was really quite good. And one thing, you know, as you know, the Army didn't discriminate. We were way ahead of everyone. So we didn't discriminate. Of course, in World War II, we did have some units. There was one unit on the Burma Road small unit, just had black nurses. This is from almost my hometown.
Is it?
Yeah. And I think it
maybe
was.
Maybe Mary Kennedy wrote that one.
Yeah.
Lehighton. Okay.
It's a community not too far from Pennsylvania, I mean from my hometown. I would say 50 miles or so, not far.
Maybe that was a little Mary Kennedy insert there.
Could be. But I think we had a, I don't think this was a model, but there again, that hat is that rolled forward. But I think they wanted to show the hat. If they would have had it back, where we see we put it with two bobby pins right here.
So and on the back.
On the back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it would show up to the front here. It wouldn't be like that.
Right. So she looked like maybe she's not a model, but
I think she's a nurse. I think so. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Now this one has his cap a little bit better, see? Down in the back. That's a good one. You know, when I was young, we worked so hard, but then we'd have a good life at night. Horseback rider, tennis, golf, everything. You know, with 4-6. Remember, see, I don't know. I didn't choose the Army nurse.
It's officer nurse one.
I think so.
This is my favorite out of all of them.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, she's in the fatigues.
Yeah,
she probably would have worn.
See, this is the uniform that we made available to. I don't know if I mentioned it here, but it's a good story. When the Cuban crisis occurred, Colonel Parker was chief. That was the predecessor of Colonel Clark. And when she went down to Florida to see the nurses, you know, whether how they were mobilized, they were wearing all sorts of uniforms. See, they had the white uniform, but your white uniform wasn't needed if we were going against, well, we didn't know what we were going to do then under President Kennedy. But she's all different types of shoes. She was so disappointed. But I guess they just wore whatever they had. Maybe they, it's still in Vietnam. I remember going over one time, and the chief nurse of the 8055, when I met her, she was so small, and she preferred using the men's uniform. I just about was in shock, because we had worked so hard to get a female uniform and boots for the first time. Female boots. We weren't using men's boots. We were... World War II, look, we didn't have any boots at all. We had to have them made by the Indians. So we did progress. But in my time then, we did get mandatory uniform. That was Colonel Harper's. That's one of the jobs she gave me when I went down to work for her. See, I worked with Colonel Harper for a short time before I became assistant chief. And she put me on that job. And of course, it wasn't finished until I became chief. We got it into regulation.
And that's
the uniform? Put the scissor there, and then see in the pocket here to put whatever you wanted in the pocket. I sort of think that was a nurse. I don't think this was. I don't know. Marion would know better than I. Now, see, this would mean that this nurse served in another area. Or no, that's the Korean. No, Vietnam. Yeah, that's the Vietnam, so that would be our.
How did they do? Oh, and that's an Air Force ad that I left in there.
I can't tell you exactly, but boy, if you, I think I've tried to orient you a little bit better on how we did things.
There's all sorts of brochures, but those are the ones that I found most often.
I remember
all,
this one.
The one with all the hats.
Yep. See, here at the Ashton General Department of the Army, so on this. I don't remember approving this.
I think this one was from 62, so it would have been even before.
Yep. See, this is the white uniform we improved upon. We made it so that the sleeves, you could move forward and take care of your patients. And, I own all these uniforms that I find together.
They show a lot of uniforms in these brochures.
Well, it's just like we thought it was great to be their hostess. She had on that cape, you know. My cape that I had for nursing students. Did you ever see any of those capes?
I think.
Yeah, mine's up in the historical unit of home.
Now, I was wondering about this picture and this, the new career that has been met. Are those students?
These would be students that I would be sure. These would be students being taught by Army nurses to be medics.
So the implication is you're going to be in charge of these guys.
Yeah, right.
You rank higher than them.
Oh, yes. And that was one of the big things when we had to get, when we brought in all these nurses, we had to prepare them. Mm-hmm. I think we had an 8-week course, basic training. And when we needed all these nurses over in Vietnam and throughout the world, we reduced it to about 6 weeks, as I recall, and we increased the number of courses per year. I think we went from 4 to 9 or something like that. A tremendous workload, you could imagine. They had to prepare all these individuals. And so this would have been one of those classes.
Okay.
I think it could well be since they look a little older. You know, this doesn't look like a fellow right out of high school. These could have been preparing to be what would be equal to the practical nurse. It was my time that, or was it Colonel Clark's? Then recognized by their state nurses association to be licensed practical nurses. And they
and
were
that,
given their
that
diploma.
Would have been the 91Cs?
91Cs. That's
okay.
Changed now. But at that time, 91Cs.
Okay.
And we had courses, we had classes all over the country, and nurses all over in those hospitals, you see, teaching. So that's what it is. They're older, see? So they've been basic medical technicians, gone up and up until we get to the 91C.
Because you started as a 91A.
Yes, now that's all changed, but
it was,
but that's all changed. I can't keep up with it. What they have now, roughly, as far as I understand it, it's called 91W, and it's 91C, and he can do anything. I mean, he can go in. There's no more real basic person now. Mm-hmm. He has to be prepared to be able to do anything before he goes out in the field. So if I understand it correctly, even at, say, the battalion aid stations now, they're the highest level out there. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this brochure is unique.
I remember this, though.
Has five or six different people, and it follows them, and they tell a story.
Like
and I, you know, like this person tells about being from wherever they're from, and I'm an OR nurse, or I'm going back for my MA or whatever, and they tell their own story. And I always wonder too, is this a real person, or is this sort of a script?
Well, I couldn't tell you, but
you know what I mean,
I would think it's a real person.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Because I think that would be fraudulent not to have it be a real person. That would be fraudulent.
Is this got a name and a town?
Yeah, that would be fraudulent.
Uh-huh.
So it would have to have been the real person. Second lieutenant, age 22. See, that could have been I. No, this would have to be
a real person. Oh. Yeah. I'd like to find one of those people now.
Well, you probably could. Look up
figure out who
computer.
They are.
But the trouble is, the reason you can't find them is they've married, they have a different name. Uh-huh. Unless it's someone who didn't marry, you might be able to find them.
Uh-huh.
But I know they have me all mixed up at the World War II Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody submitted my name as Lieutenant Hayes. Well, I was not a Lieutenant Hayes. That's Lieutenant McCabe. And you see, if you go down to the memorial, you know, they have where you it's all computerized.
Uh-huh.
And you could go down and find my name under McCabe.
Mm-hmm.
And you find my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And you find my sister-in-law. See, so there are three McCabes. And I was amazed at the number of McCabes that were in World War II. Absolutely amazed. But then I'm not, because the Irish always went through, served in all wars.
Uh-huh.
But my relatives came down. My great nieces, and went to the memorial, and they came back and we said, we couldn't find you. There's no picture. There's only a Lieutenant McCabe with a little bit of data, but there's no picture and so forth. And I said, well, there has to be. It's down there. And then we figured it out. So I've got to get to the memorial and get that straightened out. I have so many things to do. I'm trying to write my will. I remember this.
That one seems
what
like
year? This
for
must
a while.
Have been.
Looks like it was
62.
62, but it was around, I think, for several years.
I don't think so. Ask Mary Kennedy on this. I don't think it was before 62 because they didn't. Unless, let me. Is there anything about?
This is where I get the date on that little number at the bottom versus 1962.
Yes, it was printed in 1962 by the government printing office.
Okay.
So that would be 62.
But it probably used for several years. And it,
well, I'll tell you, they never had much
color.
Money before. You know, Colonel Haynes, who became the director of NLN when she retired, was really one who put great emphasis on nursing education. And she was the predecessor to Colonel Harper. And she was there from, '55 to '59. And it's possible that this was brought out during her time. But monies were not available. They didn't have monies in those days to go out and hire an advertising company.
Right.
See? So I doubt if it had been many years before. And I would think that this would be one of those that she worked on and her staff. With the nurse recruiter, if they had one in the office, they probably didn't even have one. You know? I don't know. Marion might give the history. And is the history on recruiting written in the history? Not much.
There's some on recruitment, but it's more general information about Operation Nightingale and that sort of thing. And the problem with this is, as well, that I contacted the recruiting command where it is now, and they've thrown away all of their records. And I asked this to general, I thought they were lying or just a mistake. Or surely the military doesn't throw anything away.
That would happen.
And they told the same thing to General Slowitzky.
Yeah.
That everything's been thrown out. There may be copies at the National Archives, but
that's where you can get. That's where.
I hope there's copies of something. because I just wonder, when they came up with this, certainly somebody had to sit down and meet and discuss and say, no, put this word here, this picture, not this picture. Right. And it would be interesting to see what was kept or what was thrown out and how those kind of decisions were made. But it seems as though a lot of that has been
during my time, we were so busy. I wish I could have written a lot of stuff. But 7 days a week, for years, I was really burned out. But 7 years I had, the world was going on when I was assistant teacher. But they made us empty our files every year. And all the material was sent out to St. Louis. Well, then there was a fire, so I don't know what was saved. But I do know the archives has a lot of material because people who have been researching different areas about the Army Nurse Corps. I'll tell you one person. Have you gotten in touch with Kate Scott?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to her tomorrow, actually, at the Wednesday.
Well, I think she has a copy of this.
Okay.
And I think I gave her a copy of this.
Okay.
Let me just answer the phone.
Okay.
And then, you just might glance at that.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me. See, this is mostly about my home. This is from home.
Everybody's got different questions.
Yeah, this is more personal.
Uh-huh.
This is more professional. So, you see, he says to me, books, and I said, well, many people have asked me to write a book, especially after I was promoted, but I've never authorized anyone to do so. I was chief during the worst years in Vietnam from 67 to 71. Build up began in 65 and I was assistant chief, We were extremely busy. Well, you see, with him, I didn't go into very many details. The Army had 103 medical units at that time throughout the world. I was responsible at that time for over 21,000. There were 8,000, 8243 or something, military and civilian prisoner, and the manual was civilian. So it was quite a responsibility. This sort of thing, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. going, but it's more personal. I think she has a copy of this. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's too much in there on Vietnam. Yeah, I think this is more personal than. Well, if you're going to see Kate Scott, she's a tremendous gal. Have you met her?
I haven't met her. I've just talked to her over email, actually.
She's younger than you are, I think, yeah. Yeah, yes, she is. But I think she has a copy of this.
Okay.
So if she does, she could give it to you, and that pretty well covers most of my background.
Okay.
As far as my personal uh-huh. background is concerned. And I know she has a copy of this.
Okay.
And you ought to talk with her what's in the archives, because mm-hmm. she spent a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. She made a movie on me for the Smithsonian.
She said I can watch it too.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Gosh, I think she did a good job.
Uh huh. Let's see. So that first brochure is in '62, and then there's others from.
Oh, did I get that? Oh,
that's right.
Yeah.
No, that's right. This one's 62, and then, let's see, what are you doing tomorrow? This was somebody else's handwriting, 68, uh-huh. but down here it says 68, so it must have.
Yeah,
so right. It's been printed.
Right. This was during my time. See, we gave them the objective,
uh-huh.
and we decided whether or not we wanted that outfit, or it may have been decided by the Army, you know, mm-hmm. that they were going to employ them. But I think we had a great input into whether or not we really wanted to keep them, see whether or not they came up with good ideas.
Uh-huh.
And if they didn't, then we would go back and say, you know, but we kept them. I remember we had that same
NWA,
yeah, that same thing. You see, now, to be an Army nurse, we would never capitalize N, because A is capitalized because of the Army, Navy, Air Force, whatever, mm-hmm. but a nurse would be. Army Nurse Corps would be.
Right.
But if you're writing about Army nursing, it should be Army and then a small N. But a lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. So this was out with a little book then, like mm-hmm. this, I guess.
Right, right.
Then this was in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where did you get these from?
At Indiana University, it was a government depository, and I was just going through one day and found a lot. And then mm-hmm. some were at the Army Nurse Corps Archives.
Uh-huh. So you've been to the historical nurse?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It
was Major Peterson the first time I went. Now it's Major Scott.
Well, see, Major Peterson wasn't there very long.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. See, the nurses who know a little bit more, who still live in the area. One is Connie Moore. She's a commandant of the USIS, where nurses are at the university. And Colonel, my memory, I know him so well. One of my nurses serves on one of my committees. But anyway, she is just retired. Debbie Cox. She was in the historical unit for three. Did you?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So she should be able to tell you. Little bit. Well, she didn't get into recruiting so much, though, but she knows the history.
Right.
So. When are you going to talk to Marion Kennedy again, do you think?
I called her a couple times recently, but haven't been able to get through, just a shame. So I'm going to start calling again when I get
Well, her stepdaughter's been living with her to try to help her out a little bit.
Okay.
But I think that she's leaving. I'm not sure. So maybe while she's there, she takes her places.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's what it is.
Okay.
But otherwise, Marion's pretty much at home. Mm-hmm. Now, what year was this?
Let's see, I have 69. I'm not here. This is mostly this professionalism. It's mostly pictures of uniforms, all of the different uniforms, summer, winter, the whites.
But you see, this is what is important. You see, it's recruiting. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But it still says that you can work at Walter Reed, Letterman, Honolulu, Medigan. Yeah. I'm sure some of this one, you know, and, uh-huh. and the other one too. You know, this is our new fatigue. See, they can wear that in or out, but I think it looks better in. But when you're taking care of patients, you know, and you're in the duty, then it gets out.
And is this the baseball cap that they complained about? That a lot of the nurses didn't like the baseball cap.
Well, but they wore the other cap. They uh-huh. wore the,
like jungle
the,
hat.
The jungle hat.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So most of the people that I've interviewed that have pictures or talk about the uniforms, it was the jungle hat.
And no,
so
that's
I was,
right.
I just noticed that the baseball
And you know,
cap,
on my trips over there, that would disturb me. It's written somewhere about me. Uh-huh. But I said to General Abrams, who was the general, I said, I don't understand. I go to one unit and the nurses are wearing their jungle hat this way, and then I go to another one, they're wearing it that way, and it's down in front. I said, isn't there one way that jungle hat's supposed to be worn? And he said something to the effect, well, that was the least of my worries. It showed the personality. And so then I recognized, you know, just let it be. You know, I don't know what the conversation was, but it was in one of these books. But, yeah, they did. They wore them all sorts of ways, you see. Uh-huh. One tilted back here and way forward, you know, like shielding her eyes, and then another one sort of tilted, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that would disturb me, because as uniforms, that's stupid for wearing uniforms correctly. Because uh-huh. If you're going to be a nurse, an Army nurse, you should be able to wear a uniform correctly. Uh-huh. I used to get teased a lot. And then one time, some nurses dug up some old photos of me. When I was a first lieutenant, I didn't know any better. But I was wearing open-toe shoes. You know, you never, And then they dug up another picture of me that I was carrying my, rushing to a helicopter, and I was carrying my hat instead of having it on my head. You know, when you're outside, you're always supposed to have your head covered. So they were holding that. Yeah, so. I'm surprised. Well, at this time, of course. See, I was on at least three recruiting brochures, uh-huh. which I have copies of, upstairs in my files. I have about 6 or 8 boxes. But when I became chief, of course, I didn't appear anymore, and uh-huh. I was older. But
so
when
you
I
were
was
in
young,
recruiting ads, too.
I was in three recruiting ads,
huh.
little brochures
uh-huh.
that they would put out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
One is with a
male nurse. We were standing over a globe, and, uh-huh. You know, it was taking the bus as though we were talking about all the places where you can be assigned.
Uh-huh.
That was taken, I think, in 56. I was about 36, but I was always young looking.
Uh-huh.
So, and then there was another one that I had a stethoscope. I was doing something to a patient.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what the third one was. Maybe just uniform. But,
you know,
I had them upstairs in the box. Recruiting command ought to have those. You say they don't have anything historic?
Terrible. They said that everything was thrown away from the Vietnam era. So I'm not sure if that meant everything before that period, too, or what. Find out more about that.
Yeah, this is, you know, it's the way to attract, mm-hmm. is to have influence. And I'm sure that this was quite, this was in color, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And folded, you see, like this.
Yeah. Yeah, and this one was a big, kind of like a booklet. It was bound here on the side, but not. It wasn't stapled. It was bound and all in color.
Yeah.
With the little girl from Pennsylvania.
I think so. Maybe not, but I think so. Oh,
lots of pictures.
Let's see some of these people I know.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure with a magnifying glass, I would know most of them. Because this is in my town. You see, these are actual nurses.
Uh-huh.
They're not.
Okay.
These are actual photos.
So we're on page 3 here.
Now she's still living in, and she's in she's in El Paso.
Okay, so the top corner picture on page 5 is a real nurse.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, right. She's a full colonel. She became a full colonel.
Huh.
I think these are that posed.
Uh-huh.
I think these are just all real.
And this is San Antonio here on
the
Civil War.
Sure. If these were enlarged, it would be better. Now, she may be posed. I'm not sure. This surely isn't posed. See, this is
okay, so the one
real. This is the real picture.
On 9, kind of a training picture, but then the one above it that she may be.
I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Is this picture with the tent, is that the basic training at Fort Sam Houston?
That's probably, yeah, that's probably, yeah. Doris Cobb is the one who could go over this and tell you.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure she could. And Marion Kennedy. Some of these may not be here. I don't, you know, there's
uh-huh. the travel pictures.
Yeah. These, I'm sure, are, you know, real pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. This, too.
The specialized, mm-hmm. or the different specializations.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure these are. These would be younger than I, you see, and that's why I recognize that one because she's older now and still on active duty. I mean, still retired, but still alive. People wonder if I'm still alive, so my age group would all sort of look on. I'm sure these are not, I think these are real, real. I don't even have anything to publish on today. No, it's not Army. That looks like Navy.
24?
Huh. I don't know, but that's not an Army cap. Could these be student nurses?
Well,
what are they talking about?
It's on
about?
The page for financial aid.
Well,
so
that's why then.
See,
these are cadet nurses. I don't know whether they had a cap or not, because, yeah, that's helping out. They're not Army nurses. They're prior to. But it might have been, these are, I think it's sort of staged. And these were graduates. Maybe they went into a graduate program. Well, here it explains all these programs. See, to a master's degree nursing. I remember as assistant chief, I just become assistant chief. I didn't know too much about these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent to the University of Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh,
uh-huh.
to be a recruiting agent and then to give a speech on recruiting. And, you know, it was like learn it overnight, you know. And the girl, you know, if you want to really talk with someone who is excellent and was in recruiting in the 60s, is the friend of Jen Southby's. And a wonderful person, and she wouldn't mind me calling her. She's a colonel retired. She's on my committee of three. And she was the recruiter in Pittsburgh when I went out there. I'll never forget it. She was a great help to me. But she might be able to give you background that I can't. Her name is spelled MC, capital LOUGLH, LIN, McLaughlin, and Audrey, AUDRE. And she lives and she's moving, but she will be here for 2 months or so. And I think Audrey was also stationed in Vietnam. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think so. Mm-hmm. Not sure. It's hard to remember all of that, mm-hmm. you know.
We should have to remember everybody else.
She went to Columbia. Yeah. She went to Columbia at the same time I was there. She was a young nurse. She was telling this story. And she didn't know how to write to the Department of the Army. Uh-huh. And I think she was there as one of the Army student programs. Mm-hmm. I'm not positive about that. But anyway, she had to write to the Army. So I think she was, or she wouldn't have had to write to the Army. So I sat down here. I was, you know, a major. I knew everything. She thought I knew everything. And I wrote out, you know, the outline and so forth to use. And she always tells people about this letter, that if it wasn't for the letter that I wrote for her, that she would never have. And in that letter, she asked to be assigned to Walter Reed. And so her first assignment was at Walter Reed. Uh-huh. And she went up through the ranks and she became chief nurse of Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. That was what I always wanted to be, chief nurse of Walter Reed. Uh-huh. But I was plucked when I was young, not to sit to be assistant chief, youngest chief, assistant chief, youngest chief. You know. So I never got to be what I really wanted to be. And I tell the story about General Eisenhower when I was taking care of him as president. He told me the story how he always wanted to be the head of the school that we had at Fort McNair. And he never became that either, you know? He became
just the president.
Yeah, just the president. But before that, he became chief of staff, you see, of the Army. And then he became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So, I mean, how high can you go? But that's what he wanted to do. See, he always wanted to be that head of that school. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't always get what you want.
You just get to be president.
So, well, this is good that you have this, and I'm glad you're talking to Kate.
Uh-huh.
And she'll give you a lot of cues. Mm-hmm. I know she has a copy of this.
Uh-huh.
Now, where it is, I don't know. But I know that she has a copy of it. Because this is from where she, I think, and talking with me, of course, that she got the material for the Smithsonian. Because my flag and everything, my uniforms, they're all over in the Smithsonian. Uh-huh. My gun isn't. You know, when you become a general officer, you get a gun. And a huge general officer belt, big buckle, and so forth. Well, I gave that all to my nephew, which I shouldn't have done, really. But, you know, I thought, well, who's, you know, nobody's going to want stuff from me, you know. And, of course, now the Smithsonian is still waiting for it. But my nephew, it's in storage in the garage at one of the houses he owns. And so he's promised me, and I know he will, give it to the Smithsonian someday. But I've never used it. But it was the first gun, don't you see, given to a female.
Uh-huh.
So for the Smithsonian, not to, of course. So what haven't we covered? I haven't gone in detail about a lot of things.
Yeah. What sorts of problems did the Army Nurse Corps face in trying to get more nurses during Vietnam in particular? I mean, with World War II, you have this attack at Pearl Harbor, and everybody kind of rushes forward to enlist, but with Vietnam it was sort of different and drug out, you know, over a period of years.
Right.
So how did,
but I
miss, were there problems or did,
well,
you?
Well, I can't say and truthfully say that there were problems in recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at how many nurses we had throughout the United States,
mm-hmm.
we did very, very well. And if you compare them, if the staffing of the hospitals at that time in the community and the staffing of the Army Nurse Corps, I'm sure that we were equal, or maybe we needed it better.
Mm-hmm.
But we needed nurses right away because of the war. Now, did we have people who didn't want to go? I'm sure there were some nurses who didn't want to go, but we never had a nurse that I know of that we had to send to jail,
uh-huh.
you know, or to give her any sort of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Or to have a courts martial.
Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't have that problem. So I don't think you can say that we had a problem. We just need nurses because they were needed throughout. Remember, it was 63 that the Surgeon General put out that big report, you know, nationwide, shortage of nurses.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. So, in the war started, well, actually, the Vietnam started before 63, as you know. We didn't have any great need for nurses. But when we started the buildup in 65, you see, we already had a lot of nurses, but then those nurses sort of dwindled, and that's why we had to go back out again in my time, as well as when I was assistant chief for nurses. I know of no literature, unless there's something that was in one of the Army journals, the Journal of Nursing, talking about shortage of Army nurses. I know of nothing that was written anywhere that would verify it, you know, that we had problems. Gosh, when you think of the nurses who wanted to go the second time, and they did, they served the second time. I hesitated to send them the second time. They wanted to go. Have you talked to any of those nurses?
I've talked to a few that went twice.
I'm trying to pinpoint, you know. Well, we did draft, remember, male nurses. And we did that because we wanted, I believe at the time, to have more male nurses, which we didn't have. And then, of course, we had this warrant officer program. And I think you probably read about that. But that wasn't too successful because most of them were men. And they felt they were doing the same work that a commission officer was doing at the bedside. And they were. They were taking temperatures, they were taking blood pressures, they were giving direct nursing care. But you see, with their two-year preparation, they could not have become head nurses, supervisors, and assumed positions of greater responsibilities in the clinical specialties. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want anyone over you teaching you how to take care of a patient who's seriously ill unless they were prepared to be able to do that. And so that program then finally dwindled out. Mm-hmm. Another pressure we did have was from the American, I keep saying American Journal of Nursing, but the ANA was to take those two-year graduates and commission them. And we thought that it wasn't, the ANA didn't look upon us very favorably. But prior to that, though, and after that, the ANA just loved us, and they did much toward getting legislation passed, as did many other people, to take away the restrictions so that we could have a general officer and advance, so there was no problem. Then, of course, long time after I was out, was this policy with don't ask, don't tell. And I don't know, I don't even want to discuss that because I really don't, I wasn't in the office at that time. And I don't know how it affected nurses. I really don't. I'm sure that we had homosexuals in the nurse corps. Because we had them everywhere, right? It's not just nurses. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. I'm looking at the Kennedy Center right now, and I'm sure there are people who work there mm-hmm. who are. So it was just a part of our society that made it, I don't know how it's going to be in the future, but it made it difficult at that time if they had positions of responsibility, not in the nurse corps, because they weren't going to give away secrets. But if they were in intelligence or some other position, it was very difficult. And that's the Army's position. And that's why that there's so much against homosexuality in the armed forces. If they hold that position, that has a secret. Because then whoever wanted to blackmail them could easily do so. But I think that is disappearing from our culture. You know? So I don't know what's going to happen. I sort of think that policy is going to be removed. Don't quote me on that for sure. I don't know. I have no knowledge. Yeah. Absolutely yeah. No knowledge.
What would have happened, you know, if there had been a nurse, male or female, in Vietnam, who had been homosexual? Would that have been an issue? Or would it have just been...
I doubt if we would have known it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It seems to me somewhere along the line we did have some problems. But they were generally taken care of at a lower level. Either right in the command or at the next high level. Mm-hmm. It generally didn't come into the office of the chief of the corps. Mm-hmm. We have greater things to worry about. Mm-hmm. But somebody would, of course, have been responsible for that. Would have gone to the chief nurse in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And then from that chief nurse would have gone to the theater chief nurse. Mm-hmm. So the Far East would have had a chief nurse station in Hawaii, you see. And then if that were settled at that level, that command, then it could have gone forward. But I doubt it. I doubt it. Just like if anyone needed a courts martial, that would be handled at that level. Mm-hmm. It would certainly come to me.
think that people at that time had stereotypes about male nurses that they were homosexuals? Or do you think those men faced that?
I can't speak for the men, and I never heard anyone express that to me. Uh-huh. And I brought in my office, I brought in two male nurses. My office, I'm talking about personnel and everything, mm-hmm. all those things that were underneath me, uh-huh. and the Surgeon General's office. I had two male nurses that were in the career, or they were in the assignment branch, mm-hmm. and I never heard that remark. I don't have any knowledge of that. But I'm sure one of them was, when I look back upon it, mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't have discussed it with them. Mm-hmm. Didn't think about it. Uh-huh. To me, he was a nurse.
So would have probably just been sort of left alone and not even brought up, don't make an issue.
I don't think we made an issue out of anything like that. But I'm sure that if there was misbehavior at some level, that would have been corrected. At least I hope so. But there wasn't any. Those men that I brought into my office, I mean, worked, did their duty more than what they should have done. They were so busy. Went home to their respective apartments, so I wouldn't have any knowledge.
Yeah.
And they weren't certainly, you can't look at a homosexual and say it's homosexual.
Yeah, I just always wonder because, you know, when men first come into nursing, you read, and I didn't live there, but you read that people thought they were homosexual.
Right, because it was an effeminate mm-hmm. profession mm-hmm. in those days.
Right, yeah. And I always wonder what it's like for those first people doing that. Now, it's not such a big deal, even though there's still very few men in nursing, relatively, but... Still
right, but it's just like at home now.
You don't think about
my sister was very ill. It was the nursing assistant who was changing her pads and so forth. And my sister didn't think anything about it. I've never worked taking care of a patient with a male nurse. Mm-hmm. I've had male nurses taking care of me. Mm-hmm. But going back into my own career as a nurse who gave professional care, I never worked with a male nurse. Mm-hmm. I only worked with an administrative role. At the highest level, see, right in the office of the chief. But I know that we were very grateful that we had all of our male nurses in Vietnam, and your emphasis is on Vietnam. And if we had not been pleased, we certainly wouldn't have increased the nurses from, what was it, 11 or 12 percent? Oh, that was the total army. But there were very few male nurses at first, and then we went up to almost 25 or 27 percent. So you know they were doing a good job and doing what they were supposed to do. And if, as I say, there was any difficulty, it would have been handled at the level down in the field, what we call the field in Vietnam. That's what we would call the field.
And I've read in Sarnak's book about, and I'm not sure, I think it was the person before you, I think it was General Clark.
Colonel Clark,
then, that's right, who... She was asked for X number of male nurses, and she said, no, I wouldn't send this many nurses, and if they're males or females, this is just what you get. She wouldn't make that sort of gender-specific.
That's right. Well, we didn't. Mm-hmm. We didn't. Except that when we got later on, you see, in Vietnam, where we needed them, we had so many casualties, and the stronger men, you know, lifting those litters and moving those orthopedic patients and all those patients that couldn't move. The male nurse certainly made significant strides, and they were ready to really take care of these patients. Mm-hmm. I can't remember Colonel Clark saying that, but sometimes those things get into print. And I think what she was trying to say is, I would say, don't ask me for black, white, male, female. Just ask for a nurse, mm-hmm. and that's what I'll do. Because actually, to tell you the truth, Colonel Clark wasn't the one who made those decisions.
Uh-huh. It was done somewhere.
It was done right in our office mm-hmm. by the personnel, chief of personnel. And we had, in my time, how many nurses assigned in the personnel? We were so busy. Mm-hmm. And so we also, in our office was a nurse, just assigned to recruiting, who received all the applications to come into the Army Air Support. So that was another form of recruiting, because we tried to take the best we did. In here, I think I tell about the RAIN program's numbers of people we had. Because the program started in 64.
Uh-huh.
It's a four-year program. So 68, you would be talking to one of the first graduates mm-hmm. of that program.
I forget, she was in Vietnam in 69, 70, maybe, so.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I wonder who that was. I'm sure I would know her. You don't remember the name? Now, you're young. You should remember. I'm
old. I've seen her face. Her father was career Army.
Oh. Stubbingus? No. It's okay. Yes.
I can see your
now,
face.
I can say I forget. I can't remember, but not you. Not at your age.
I'll remember tonight.
Yeah.
No doubt. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. So the male nurses were drafted, but I think there was a call for 700 for the Army and 200 for the Navy.
Navy,
but
there was a short of
50 or
right,
something.
Right.
Was there ever talk of drafting female nurses?
Oh, no.
At that point?
No. Oh, no. Never. As I said, the legislation was there. You know, it was written in during World War II, but it was never necessary to use it. Now, had we gone out for nurses, well. Let's put it this way. If we didn't let the nation know we needed nurses, how would they know that we would need them?
Uh-huh.
So that was the reason that we had this Operation Nightingale. We let the public know that we need you. We uh-huh. need you. Come. Uh-huh. Had no trouble coming, you uh-huh. see. They were. So there was no need, because I really feel I can say this with all sincerity, that if the nurses needed to serve her country, that nurse will serve. Just like I did. I didn't know too much about it. But I knew that if we were going to win this war, World War II, each one of us had to do something. And each one did, whether they were at home helping out in the factories or saving tin cans. The little kids would go around and pick up the tin cans, and everyone worked. So, never had any trouble. I don't think you'll ever have to use a draft for female nurses, women nurses.
What about male?
For the Army Nurse Corps? I don't know what. I don't think they will need it for them either. There's a difference, though, in the male nurse that I had during or served when I was chief and the male nurse today. The male nurse at that time, most of them were not married. They did not have children. Mm-hmm. And today, I don't know the percentage, but it's very high. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that somebody knows. Mm-hmm. Maybe 50, 60% mm-hmm. of the men are married with children.
Today.
So the men know that they can come in with their families. The female knows that now, too, mm-hmm. you see. So I don't think you're ever going to have to draft nurses to serve in the military services. Whether it's Army, Navy, or Air Force. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
And there never was really even the situation. And I guess I get this from, I think Spurgeon Neal, his book on the medical service of Vietnam, and there's others, and they talk about the Army Nurse Corps always needing more nurses. And part of that being met by hiring civilians at home, maybe, and sending more people abroad. But they always talk about there being a shortage of nurses. But
there is a shortage in specialties.
Okay.
You know, you're always going to have that.
Uh-huh.
Just like that, today there's a shortage in medical corps physicians in certain specialties.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure the same thing exists with nurses right now today.
Uh-huh.
And they may well have to take all of the nurse anesthetists, female, from, say, the hospitals that are in the States, and be sure that they have, because when you rotate, you not only have a nurse there, but you have to have one on the way.
Mm-hmm.
say, so that takes two people right there for that one space. Mm-hmm. So it takes, say, one's there, one's have to be going to replace her within a year's time. I think the tour over there is a year. So it's a rotation base that's very active. So it means that, yes, there is a shortage then in the United States, that we'd have to then civilianize the space. But believe me, I always preach, and I saw it was written in here, once you civilianize the space, you never get it back. It remains civilianized. That's true. It happens all the time. So that makes it very difficult for the Army nurse then. She has to take all the night, not the night duties, that's wrong, but she has to take the undesirable assignments, like going to Alaska all the time, although Alaska is a wonderful assignment, but it's not home. You know, it's not in the States. Or maybe she's the one that has to go to Korea right now. You see, there's no war over there, but we have nurses. Or she may have to go to another undesired assignment, you see, because the civilian nurse can't be sent. So you have to weigh the pluses and minuses when you're determining what to do in that situation. But that's, I think, what General Neal was referring to.
So for you as Chief 67, you know, during the height of the war, when there were the most nurses there, 69.
I fought against civilianization of anything.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But it wasn't a matter of we need nurses now or we're going to have problems assigning people.
No,
it wasn't.
No. That wasn't that dire. You always are going to have problems, mm-hmm. you know, in one situation or another, where one hospital may be a little short in one specialty. But in the old days, as I call my era, you see, we had a chief nurse of each army, uh-huh. and if she would see that a hospital needed X person in that given specialty over there, they would be transferred. Mm-hmm. And it was the same way in Vietnam when the 171st in Pleiku needed nurses. The nurse in Vietnam, the chief nurse, immediately transferred nurses from the 8055 over to Pleiku. And it was when those four nurses, you may have read about this, but when those four nurses, two nurse anesthetists and two operating room nurses, two men and two women, when they returned to their base in 8055, there was a huge mountain there. And they hit that mountain, and that's when they died. But if they had never been sent, they would still be alive, I'm sure, today. But it's one of those things, you see. But that didn't mean that we had to jump right away and get two more nurses into that 8055 because those four nurses went over to help out. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, that hospital may have not had an unload, a huge load of casualties coming in. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you've ever not seen, because you don't work in a hospital, but those casualties come in. I can remember in Korea, every train load that would come down from North Korea, or the area in which we were fighting, which really was North Korea, as we pushed back the North Koreans and then they pushed us back, mm-hmm. We got one night 300 patients. You see, it's unbelievable what happens in wartime. And the nurse has to be able to prioritize. You have to decide which patient, you know, you should be taken care of first with a doctor. And you put those, you hate to do it, but those who can live, you're sure are going to live. If they can wait a couple of hours, you do them second. You do the first, you do those that you know are going to live if you do something. Those you know you absolutely aren't going to be able to help, you just may do them second if they want to wait there to be operated on, I'm talking about, in the operating room. Because we had eight tables going in Korea. And at most we get 5-6 hours a night. Generally we got about 3 or 4 hours a night. We generally got 5 or 6 hours a night, but often it's just 3, 4. We worked around the clock in the operating room open 24 hours. It takes a certain type of individual, and sometimes a brand new nurse just not really taking care of patients, but a graduate of a baccalaureate degree program that doesn't have much hands-on, mm-hmm. at least then they didn't. They may have more now. By that I mean actual taking care of patients. And then they're thrust into war. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. So it takes a certain type of individual. Mm-hmm. Right. It's going to be able to handle that situation psychologically, physically, everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. But I did it. But I was a 3-year diploma. I had experience before I went overseas, so that made a difference.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular problems that you thought the war in Vietnam created for the nurse corps? In recruitment and in assignments and doing actual nursing in Vietnam? Was Vietnam different somehow than other wars, or was it very similar?
War is war. And war is, as the men say, don't quote me, war is hell. War is war. It's never good. And we had the same in World War II, the same in Korea, the same in Vietnam. I'm sure the people over there in Iraq have the same. The casualties are in, and all you can think of is just taking care of them. And in the operating room, the activity is so great. I mean, on the wards, the patient at least is put into a bed and is taken care of right there. But you can imagine the activity of that's pre-op and operating and then just immediate post-op. It's the same anymore. I don't think the Vietnam War created any problems for us.
Was it?
We didn't like war. Nobody likes war. Remember, the nurses, you know, when I came back, I was in recruiting, I think, at that time, or with a recruiting nurse in San Francisco. And someone spat upon me. I was in my Army green uniform walking down one of the main streets. And we medics, we didn't decide we were going to go over to Vietnam. We didn't decide it was going to be a war. That came to our president of the United States. And yet, those people who were anti-war veterans, I mean, not anti-war veterans at that time, but anti-war, when we returned, I mean, it was, I mean, when my nurses returned, I shouldn't say my nurses, but when the Army nurses returned, it wasn't fair to them because they were serving their country at the direction of the president. But this felt like, remember, who spat upon me, I just walked on, you know. Didn't have any words.
You think that made it more difficult for nurses, the anti-war protest? Or?
Well, of course. I mean, anybody who's in, just like today in Iraq, when I think of anybody who, it's not that I'm, I think they should state their positions because I think they should, but I could say that that does have effect on those people over there. Just as it, when in Vietnam War, I knew about it because I was here, and then I went over to visit 3 times, so I knew about it. They would get it second and third hand, it'll be published, and then they would hear about it. I know it would affect them. Here, this fellow's losing a limb, and over there in the States, with all the things that they have, they're criticizing this poor soldier.
Was it? Do you think there was any protests among troops or medical staff in Vietnam? You know, people who maybe were there 6 months and then decided that they were against the war.
I know of no one, of course. I know of no one. It wouldn't come up to me. I wouldn't know. I can't imagine it in the medics. I know that there was some dissent because some of the officers, I forget what they call it, but they were shot or injured, whether they call it defrauding or something. And I read about it, you know, but I surely wasn't aware of drugs and so forth in Vietnam. It's hard to soldier on, as they say, when you have someone against what you're doing for your country. But I don't think, nurses are different. Because we have one goal, one objective, and that is to take care of that patient. And generally, you don't let your personal feelings interfere with what your objective is. I can't speak for all nurses.
But do you think it's possible maybe for a nurse to say on one hand, I don't agree with the war, but my job isn't
to
nurse.
Oh, sure.
To do that.
Yeah.
Even to be totally opposed to, say, Vietnam, for instance, or any war.
But I doubt it, because, of course, we have a volunteer army now. It's a little different. In Vietnam, we did not have a volunteer army. So those people who were drafted, I'm sure, felt that way. We didn't draft nurses. So anyone who came into the army, we weren't pulling them in. They came in on their own free will. Maybe they were disappointed, but I don't know of any nurses. Of course, I may be prejudiced, but I wouldn't give up that experience for anything. I'm sure that every nurse who served in Vietnam became more aware of others, became more passionate, had more empathy, understood so much more about the world and our culture, appreciated more what we had back here in the States after they returned home. I know I did after 2.5 years in the jungle. And we didn't have what the person has today. Now they have emails, telephones, good food, warm, you know. We didn't have any of that, you see. We did have emails, but they were essentially so, and occasionally my mother would write, and I would write to the bell cut out, you see, because if I couldn't say where I was or what I was doing. Or whatever. So I can't speak for the person today, but it just seems to me that if we have anyone here is against the war and it gets back to the troops, it hurts their morale. Here they are fighting for their country and losing a leg and losing an eye. I know when the last one of the last visits in Vietnam, I went to see every patient. And, you know, they'd only be kids like they are today, 18, 19, their eye out or a limb gone or some extremity. It's so sad. That's what gives us our freedom. So, I know in World War II, you know, when we had the Japanese that bombed us, I mean, you could feel the anxiety of people wanting to help their country. And I was just part of that. There aren't too many of us left from World War II in Korea. Some, of course, from Vietnam. That's why I want you to speak to Colonel Southby if you can. And recruiting, a good one would be if you can't get to Colonel Cobb. You know, Colonel Kennedy would give you, I'm sure, Colonel Cobb's number. They're close friends. Colonel Cobb was the nurse at USAREC. And as I said to you, I think she was our first nurse at USAREC. So she would tell how it was all organized. If you really want to know about our organization.
I need to talk with her.
Yeah. Doris Cobb. Do you have her name?
Mm-hmm. I have it. So what kind of changes in policy were happening in the late 60s in Army Nurse Corps in terms of you could be married by this point, but somewhere in there, was it 70 or 71, you could have children now?
Oh, it was just before I retired. We wanted to retain in the late, well, this was the late 60s. The Chief of the Air Force, General Holmes today, the colonel then, and I thought very much that it was a shame that we had these highly qualified nurses, and if they had married, were married, and had children, they had to leave. And we were particularly interested I was particularly interested in the nurse whose husband was also in the service, you see. So, both of them doing a good job. And they could both be nurses, you see. So it was those people. The man, of course, could stay in. The wife then would have to get out of the service. And so there was an Army directive that came, I think it came out in 1970. I think I mentioned in this book, in 1970. And the Army directed that we would then retain married nurses and Army personnel. But I can tell you that General Holman, we never thought it would, that we're married to another officer. See? But now, when the Army brought out that directive, it pertains to everyone. So I never dreamed that that would happen, because now they're retaining single officers, you know, who are never married with children. So I hear. And that wasn't our intent, I can tell you. We wanted not to lose the nurse who was highly qualified and married to another nurse or married to another officer.
So in 70,
that was about 69. No, it was about 69, wasn't it?
Okay. So that one said you have to be married you can't just be a nurse, have a baby, and stay in. You have to be married to another officer.
That's what we wanted, yeah, when we were talking about it.
When you were talking
about
it.
And we got into an Army. And we got it into a directive. And I think it was just before I retired or after, I can't remember. Uh-huh. After I retired, then it became, I'm sure it became, I guess it became legislatively. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Well, I do know we had a directive, a policy, an AR, which permitted the married nurse with children to stay in. But then, as I said, when it was further directed, it either became legislation just before I retired or right after. I think before I retired. But we did have the Army directive. I should say, I'm sure it was DOD, Army, Navy, Air Force. Of course, we were only interested more or less in the Army. But I think it was a DOD directive. But we started it in the Army. And then at that time, now, you're married, you have children, you're divorced, or you have children, or you're never married and have children. It's all just like the society is. It's a composite of society. It wasn't good to have all those restrictions. But, you know, you're going to make changes gradually.
And so this is the time when those laws were changed that would allow for one general officer. Was it only one?
Just the law that she did not allow for any. It just removed the restrictions.
Okay.
And made it possible.
Okay.
That if the Army wanted to have a female general, they could do so.
So it didn't say you will have one.
And it took 2.5 years, and there's much discussion. I know Mary Sarnecki has, you know, that they were arguing where the star should come from, the Army Medical Department or the line. You know what I'm talking about?
I kind of understand.
All right. That would mean it would have to come with a general, with the number of stars that would be given to the Army Medical Department, or it would come out from the stars of all the line officers. That would be the infantry, artillery,
okay,
chaplains,
so
or whatever.
So in effect,
it would have to come out,
one.
Right.
Okay.
Now that's what Sarnecki says.
Okay.
I can remember General Westmoreland telling Colonel Clark after I retired that he recommended to DOD, which would have been the Secretary of Defense, and it was returned twice. But then later I got from the Surgeon General himself that it was General Woolnough down at Konark who was willing to give up the star and with no trouble. And so then it wasn't right to just make the chief of the Army Nurse Corps. They had to also make then the female chief in line, a general officer. And so Konar then gave up 2 stars. And that's not the way. You know, things are written and you just can't. People tell stories and you don't know what's really true. But I know I discussed this with General Huizington just maybe 2-3 months ago before she had stroke. That was the girl who was promoted with me. Mm-hmm. And she said, such rubbish. See? Because she worked right over there in the DOD. And she knew there wasn't any friction about where the star was going to come from. It was just a matter, all of a sudden they had to decide, yes, we want a female, you know? Mm-hmm. And the logical person would have been a nurse because the nurses were always loved by the men in the Army. And I would think, and also I was senior, and I was also from the senior corps, the branch, the Army Nurse Corps. So it was logical that it would be, I'm sure, an Army nurse.
So you think if there had only been one promotion, it would have been you?
I wouldn't want to say that.
Okay.
Because who knows?
Uh-huh. But once they decided to give one star, then they decided to give two.
Right.
Was there reasoning behind that? Or?
No, it's just what they wanted to do.
Just to do it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the Air Force eventually saw it and said, oh, we don't like this.
Uh-huh.
So it was about 1.5 years, then they promoted Colonel Holmes. Mm-hmm. And it took the Navy, it was, they promoted a nurse, the Navy, General Home was lying. Then the Navy, it took them about 2.5 years after I was promoted to promote an admiral. And they didn't want to do it because it had to be a two-star. It was a really strange thing. And then the Army realized, the Air Force realized, well, I would, if I were able to stay in, which I wasn't at that time, see, you just couldn't, there was no legislation, no directive or anything to retain a female general, you see. But over time, of course, that changed. But the story goes, again, rumor, but the Air Force said, well, we better promote our one star to two stars before the Army does it.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I was retired by that time. And and that's how, then. So the rumor goes that the Air Force then wanted to beat the Army, because we had beat them, don't you see?
Uh-huh.
The Army had beat the Air Force, and getting, which brought all the publicity worldwide, uh-huh. as you know, probably. Or maybe you don't know, but... So we were promoted in the, and the only reason we were both promoted at the same time or in the same location was for logistics, because they had to bring in all the big people, you know, from everywhere, all the congressmen and the thing. Had no room for my friends. It was lucky that had room for my family,
uh-huh.
and General Huizington only had her family.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the former chiefs came. There was room for them, and we had ANA and NLN. Those are nursing associations. And, and the former chiefs, but yeah, it was quite an exciting occasion.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to separate fiction from the truth, and it's hard to get at sometimes.
Uh-huh.
But only I will. No one will ever really know the ramifications of what went in the discussions.
Uh-huh.
You know what was what. No one will really ever know.
What do you think what it was?
I think it was General Heaton, the Surgeon General. Good friends with General Woolnough. The law had been passed. I was in the White House, at the time. I read the, I got a pen that President Johnson used. I gave it to the museum, and then I took it back because I didn't think the Army Medical Museum was going to give it to one of the Army museums. But anyway, I read a citation because we had just given a nurse the who'd returned from Vietnam, an award, and so I read that in the White House. It was a very, very exciting occasion. But my own opinion is that the law had been passed. Mm-hmm. Didn't say there should be, or there shall be, or there will be. It removed the restrictions and increased the number of colonels and so forth that the Army women could have. Because prior to that time, only 2% could be women in the military, which wasn't right. And so I think probably they got together, and I have no idea, but I do think that they probably got together. I know that it was General Woolnough who should be given a lot of credit from what I've heard, rumors, after. I don't have any facts, so we can't use it as facts.
Mm-hmm. What was all that publicity like? First woman general, what's that like? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, I was so busy with my job, but, you know, I really was. I was in the midst of the Vietnam War. Well, it wasn't in the build-up. It was at the end, but we were still very, very busy. And busy. You know, we had 103 medical installations. So, you know, worldwide I was busy. But, yeah, it was something. I didn't realize the importance. It's just of having a female general, you know, really, or the impact that it could have made upon me. Just like when I was taking care of the president. He wasn't any president to me. He was a patient.
Mm-hmm.
I was taking care of a patient. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that was somewhat of the same thing. I was still chief of the Army Nurse Corps. That was the important thing. We only had two, I think, or one maybe, derogatory remark, and maybe that wasn't too bad. That was an Esquire. And I forget what it says offhand. It may be in here. I doubt it, but... I don't know, remember what it said, but it was something like, well, we didn't need them, you know, or something like that. But it was really funny. Most of the papers they would have and the funnies you endure, the caricatures, you'd have men sitting at a bar, and then there'd be two females walking in, and then the men at the bar would say to each other, well, they could buy the first drink. You know, this, And they were in all the magazines. They were in all the newspapers, and it was really hilarious. I have some of them up there in boxes. I know I should put that stuff. But I've been so busy and tired and sick, and my family. I keep getting to it. If I can get my will written now and all that, maybe I'll get to those boxes before too long. Because somebody else, again, has offered to help. So many people want to help, so I guess I should let them help them finish categorizing. Because everything is categorized, uh-huh. You know, all the way down from when I was a baby all the way up. The uh-huh. pictures, all the things as they should be categorized. And it's just a matter of completing it, putting more things in. Turn that over. Probably the historical unit wants it, but you know the historical unit moves from one place to the other, so you never know what's really going to happen. Now that the Army is building a museum, it's going to be here at Fort Belvoir. Mm-hmm. And that may be the place to think about it and see what people think. But I'm sure that stuff should go somewhere. But there again, when it happens to you, you don't feel important, or at least I didn't. Uh-huh. I just felt I was still Chief of the Army Nurse Corps. And I had a certain burden. Yes, sure. I had to always remember that I was a general. I wanted to be and act like a general, look like a general.
What did that mean to you, to act like a general?
It just meant that. I would always certainly keep my uniform so it would look like a uniform that would be worn by a general officer. Mm-hmm. And I would always try to do what I would expect would be right, and I don't know, every once in a while I'll get a letter from somebody who will say, we'll always remember you as the best example of a general officer or something like that, which I wouldn't want in this memo or anything that you may write, but it's nice to have people recall that and I think all the chiefs have been that way, so and I'm no exception. But to be the first was challenging. Uh-huh. So I had to set the example of what a general officer should do in the first place.
How did you take it when, you know, with the cartoons that you have the two women walking into the bar? Or
we just all laughed.
Did any of it hurt?
No, that was, they were all in jest, and uh-huh. and it was really, you could see that it was really funny, mm-hmm. and it was only one remark in Esquire. It wasn't a photo, it was just a mm-hmm. little, do we really, I can't remember, but it strikes me as I remember it, do we really need them or something like that, uh-huh.
What would you think? Or if you
well, you don't reply to those. You yeah. don't reply to those.
If you could have answered them in your head, maybe.
Oh. You're all wrong. You know, you're wrong. And now today, as you know, we have a general officer's 2 stars, 3 stars. And I really someday think there'll be a 4-star, probably a West Point graduate. I hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope it will be a West Point graduate. Mm-hmm. But other people, the first West Point graduate was just promoted this year mm-hmm. to a brigadier general mm-hmm. because they didn't take women to West Point or the Air Force Academy. Or, mm-hmm. But she was promoted, and they say she's and just an unexcelled individual and in every way. So mm-hmm. let's hope that she's going to be the one or someone else. But anyway, that's mm-hmm. quite a tribute to her. You know, those West Point, they have a rigor of a studies and those, oof, what they go through. So she's commanding a unit in Europe. That's a lot of responsibility now.
What do you think that, all this is kind of happening the same, all these things kind of happen in the late 60s, early 70s that seem to come out of nowhere. I mean, you've got Vietnam and you've got Civil Rights Movement happening, and you've got the Women's Movement happening, all these things kind of at the same time.
Well, when I would be interviewed, the one question that I would get very often is, what do you think about daycare? Daycare? I never even heard of daycare. Don't you see?
Uh-huh.
So I was almost living in another world, maybe.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that the women's movement had anything to much to do with what we had. In fact, I think nothing. Mm-hmm. If anything, I think that we in the military led, meaning Department of Defense, by promoting and putting the emphasis on the role that women played in the military, not just the general officers, but everyone. I think that impacted more than reverse.
Mm-hmm.
I know I didn't even know what daycare was.
Uh-huh.
It was just like that little nurse of mine when I was going through the line, or they were going through the line, and I was had a reception. It was down at Fort Gordon or Fort Benning, and she said something about baggage. You remember that? Well, you're too young, but gosh, I can't remember whatever it was. Something about baggage. And I thought she was talking about carrying a suitcase, but she meant something else altogether, but I wasn't with it, you see. I was a little bit older. And I can't remember now what she said. I shouldn't have brought that up. But you get so absorbed. At least, you know, we were so busy. You get so absorbed in your work. Now, after my time, or just at the end of my time, we were beginning to have civilian personnel unionized in the hospitals, which sort of created hardships at first. I didn't have any of that, thank goodness. And that came after my time. They were just beginning. The unions were being formed about the last year that I was a chief nurse. But I wouldn't have had the problems anyway as much as the hospital chief nurses, you see, because we'd have to be down at the hospital level. If you want a cup of coffee, I can make you a cup of coffee. Oh,
that's all right. The nursing changed too in this period. Just the practice of nursing, and it, I mean, it's been changing for hundreds of years. But how did that affect?
Well, I think at the end of my time, as I told you, we started placing great emphasis on the nurse clinician, and that was also happening in nursing throughout the United States. And I can remember we didn't know what we were going to call them. And I thought, well, we should call them maybe clinical specialists. Well, at that time, you referred to the 91C, mm-hmm. which came 9/11-3. They were called clinical specialists. So then we couldn't use that word. So then we went, or that phrase. So we went back to nurse clinician. And that, of course, sort of revolutionized nursing care. They had additional responsibility. And the other big thing that happened to us in the military, and that is, or I should say in the Army, is that, in the Army Medical Department, is that we were able to advance and have a Department of Nursing. Mm-hmm. See, prior to that time, we were under either the Surgical Department of Surgery or the Department of Medicine, depending upon your hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, during my time, we became a Department of Nursing. And that gave the chief of the nurse of the hospital, as we say in the old days, a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And we were then, for the first time, we had a budget.
Mm-hmm.
We had direct control over our personnel. Mm-hmm. And it made altogether difference in how we, as a chief nurse, managed the care at, say, at Walter Reed or any other given installation.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, very important for us to have that, because we were then more or less equal. And we were equal, say, to the chief of department of surgery, the department of nurse, I mean, department of medicine, or other departments. And so now you'll never go into a hospital commander's office when he's having briefings to his staff without having the chief nurse there.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, he or whoever it was
uh-huh.
may or may not have been invited.
Uh-huh.
But as chief of the department of nursing, that's one of the podcasts. And the big thing was having a budget. See, we were functioning without a budget. You got what somebody else gave you, as a matter of fact, from their budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always give credit, not myself, but General Heaton for working that out for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed the whole organization of the Class II hospitals during my time. And the nursing service became the Department of Nursing.
Mm-hmm. Does that make the nurse more autonomous, more independent?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing, you think?
Well, if she doesn't have You know, you're talking about the nurse at the bedside, or you're talking about the nurse as chief nurse of the hospital. Well, the chief nurse of the hospital gives much more independence. Mm-hmm. She has to be part of the team, mm-hmm. but she now has her budget. She has her personnel, so your personnel. So with those two things, you can do wonders. Mm-hmm. I would say it wouldn't have affected the nurse at the bedside because mm-hmm. she would be doing the same thing, except now she might have more equipment, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or whatever the chief nurse decided. But I don't think it would change the nurse at the bedside. I don't think it did. But we started calling them by different name. Mm-hmm. Instead of being just a staff nurse, she became a clinical nurse. So we kept it impressing upon everybody that nurses were clinicians. Mm-hmm. And even at the lowest level. Mm-hmm. See, at the top level then would be nurse clinician. Mm-hmm. And then it would come down. But the nurse just going into the Army, her first assignment then would be clinical nurse. That, of course, has been changed. But in those days, that was a big step. So if she were a head nurse, she'd be a clinical head nurse. Uh-huh. Clinical supervisor. Mm-hmm. And if she wasn't working with the ward, per se, and she was a nurse clinician, that made her very independent because she was the top nurse prepared. They had the same thing in the civilian community. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the civilian community was a little bit ahead of us on that because I know when I would be reading literature, and they would be talking about nurse, I don't know what they called them in those days. I think that's probably where I thought, well, you know, we've got to do the same thing. And now we have, as you probably have heard, I mean, a patient comes in, not always seen by the physician right away, but by the nurse clinician. Now it's also seen by the physician's assistant. Now that physician's assistant was in the Army, came in after the nurse clinician. So there was a lot of rivalry at first, but they're two separate, you know, two separate positions. Mm-hmm. They're both, nurse clinicians don't like to be called assistant physicians, where the other is, so it's rather a tenuous position right now, I guess, but I don't know, I can't speak for what's today, but in our time, it was the best prepared Army nurse, was the nurse clinician. Best prepared, I'm talking about clinically best prepared. As we could have had some prepared at the doctoral level or less clinician, they might have been prepared in research or education or something. They're still professional nurses, but I'm talking about clinicians, nurse clinicians.
Do you think the way that nurses are portrayed has changed since even the beginning of your career?
And my own personal career? By the community? I would think it's hard for me to tell what the community felt, you know, when you're in the Army. I think that the community has certainly became more aware of Army nurses mm-hmm. and what they did mm-hmm. because of stories written in the newspapers and so forth, which certainly were not written before World War II very mm-hmm. often. If then. And so we had much more publicity. And I think that was good for nursing, as well as Army nursing. Mm-hmm. You know, so many of the advances that the hospitals have in the community today, such as the helicopters, you know, mm-hmm. the air evacuation, as you know, that all started, not just in Korea, mm-hmm. but it started, I just read recently, I found where there was one light plane that flew over in China, Burma, India, where I was, to pick up patients in the jungle. Mm-hmm. One light plane, and that was the first really air evac. Mm-hmm. When I was stationed in Korea, we did have a few helicopters that brought patients right outside the operating room door. Mm-hmm. Well, then, as you probably read with General Neill, the father of really Army aviation, you know, we have helicopters all over the place. And then, you know, the civilian community has followed us. But how much nursing's changed from World War II to Korea, and then on to my place. It's hard for me to say it. You're talking about publicity now, or you're talking about the clinician?
Just general public perspective of
nurses. You're talking about public perspective of nurses.
The images that they hold of nurses, what you think of.
Well, I hope that improved from World War II on through to the end. Mm-hmm. I think by the time that I retired, nurses were certainly held in more esteem than they were back in the early days. Mm-hmm. And they were recognized as professional people because we had we were better prepared. They were all registered nurses. And then prepared at the baccalaureate degree level. They were always registered nurses. At the three, when I was, the diploma program was a registered nurse, but not prepared at the baccalaureate degree level. So I think that was recognized, and it was also recognized that more and more of our nurses were prepared at the doctoral level and the master's level. But I think it's our problem today. I look upon it, I was talking to the historical nurse about it, we really got to inform the public again about our Army nurses. I don't see much in newspapers these days. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a tremendous job over there in Iraq. I'm sure they are, but the patients wouldn't be. I go to Walter Reed and you see them and you talk with them. I talked with one just Friday. You don't sense that they are angry with the world. They've accepted this as part of serving their country, and they're going to go back, and I'm talking about amputees, and they're going to serve. And this is true. You see it on TV once in a while. There have been a couple programs recently showing the amputee wards. I don't know if you've seen them. But those patients out there, they hobble around and push other patients. And it's just amazing. And I think more and more, as that comes out, of course the civilian community is going to admire Army nurses. Mm-hmm. And so that might change their perspective. But do you have a feeling that Army nurses are looked down upon versus the civilian nurses?
No, I don't. I'm just, you know, you always, people write books and articles and things talking about how nurses are portrayed. And you know, kind of going back to this Florence Nightingale woman in white image and sort of the healer, and then you've got people taking nurses to the other extreme, and you've got kind of this sex object. I just wonder if you felt any of that.
No, well, of course, I didn't. I didn't, of course. Uh-huh. But I do wish they'd go back to white uniforms. They wear white uniforms in some wards at Walter Reed. But somehow, but since the schools of nursing, you know, in which our nurses are prepared, no longer wear caps, so you can't expect the Army nurse to wear a cap. Mm-hmm.
What was it about the white uniform, you think?
It signified it was a professional nurse. Mm-hmm. Now you'll find, it's even at Walter Reed, that white uniform is worn by other people, whether they're serving in the kitchen or whatever. So when you see someone in white going up the, or in fatigues or whatever, you don't know if they're a nurse unless they turn around and you see the insignia, you see, which will, you'll know immediately that they're an officer. Then you've got to look a little bit further and see if you can see the caduceus. Mm-hmm. And then you'll know that they're with an N. Because seeing the caduceus, they would be a physician. Mm-hmm. Seeing the caduceus with an S, they could be a physical therapist, they could be a dietitian. Say they have that N, that means they're a nurse. And that's what I like about it.
Uh-huh. It's not the white,
it's signifying that that individual is a professional nurse.
Yeah, I read there were, you know, about this debate whether the nurses at the third surge in Vietnam and Saigon should have to wear the white or not, or, you know, interviewing nurses, do you like it, do you not like it?
Oh, that's such an immaterial thing. Really. The third field, it was at Saigon
field, right?
And Kitty Betts was one of the first chief nurses there, and Margaret Clark was the very first. And because it was at that time, they were not busy when it was first started. That Saigon was what would be the city, and outside of Saigon and in Saigon, you would find General Westmoreland's house, don't you see? It lived in the embassy. You would find all the generals. after they'd be out in the field, they'd come back in for meetings or whatever. That was like Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And the thrust of whoever was commanding at that time in Vietnam looked upon it more or less like a city hospital, like our Walter Reed. Uh-huh. And the nurses themselves wanted to wear white. And that's how it all started. And later on, they kept on with whites. I think eventually they changed to, if they wanted to, I think they went back to fatigues, if they wanted to, but I can't remember that specifically. Seems they always remained in white. It's true, I've heard some didn't like it, but it never got back to me. You know, it would stop at the level. I just hear it now because of interviews they might give where they'd say they might not have liked it. But I don't think they really did anything much about it. You know, they were proud to wear that white uniform. I mean, it's just something to talk about. It's the way I look at it. I may be wrong. Because someone had, I can't remember now, I guess they sent the white uniforms into whatever laundry facility was available. But you see, they couldn't have worn them outside of Saigon because Saigon was the city. They had laundry facilities and so forth. But not, but I was, it's a, visiting Third Field one time when a whole, I don't know how many patients came in, maybe 60, 70 patients. And I watched those nurses, you know, categorizing them right away, you know, and then starting those IVs, and, you know, it was just tremendous. And I looked at them and I said to myself, gosh, I wonder if I was like, you know, they were just tremendous. Maybe they didn't have as much experience prior to that time, but you wouldn't have been able to tell that. I was really proud of those nurses. So I hope that the civilian community will always give, what should I say, much gratitude to those who have served their country. And I think many people think about Iraq, and they think about the patients being wounded, but I'm not sure until some of these late shows on TV that have portrayed the medical evacuation, that they didn't have thought about nurses in Vietnam. And yet nurses have always been wherever the soldier is wounded, you know, whether it's in the jungle or up in Alaska or wherever. Nurses, Army nurses have always been there wherever the Army, and the same way with the Navy. If it's on a ship, you'll find a Navy nurse. A submarine, I don't think they're on submarines. If they are, there have to be medical personnel, so they'll probably be cornered. Or a male nurse, I think the Navy has male nurses now. They didn't, yes, they have them now. They didn't. Or the Air Force will always, you'll always find an Air Force nurse, whether it's a pilot or aircraft. And I do think the community is getting more aware of this. When I think back, as your question, referring to your question, certainly more so now today with the television, but they still don't have enough publicity. We don't have enough articles. And I'm questioning it. I just called, as I told you, I talked to the Army here, the historian, and said, you have somebody over there as assigned just to write articles. And in my time, everybody, if anything ever happened to anybody in our office, it was always sent to the papers. If something would be bringing, would be sent to me from Vietnam, we'd have our PR, public relations, it's called something else now, public information, I think now, office, rewrite it, send it to the papers, and that doesn't seem to be done now. I don't know.
What about women in the military in general? I think people's perceptions of women in the military.
I think it's mixed, probably. I don't. Oh, how has it changed? Well, with all the good publicity they get, I would say it's toward the better. But then you have a general officer over there in Abu Ghraib, or whatever it's called. I mean, I was shocked. I shouldn't be talking about TV. But, I mean, I'm safe. But please, don't answer that. But so then all the good is just destroyed in that one instant. So you have to build it back again. You know, you have to have stories of what nurses are doing and what the line people are doing and what they're doing. Well, how many nurses, I mean, not nurses, we haven't lost any nurses in Vietnam, I mean, Iraq, but we've lost other people. But how many females? Pretty high, 21, 22, something, or more. Yeah. So the whole war has changed. Of course, I'm not in it now. I'm an 85-year-old woman who doesn't look at TV very much, and I read 3 newspapers every day.
Uh-huh.
I listen. Mm-hmm. I'm learning. I meet some of these youngsters. The young nurse is coming in. It's very interesting. It's a different world, of course.
Yeah.
Different society, different culture. Still, I go back to the fact that nurses will take care of patients, regardless of any extenuating circumstances.
Did you ever, anybody ever make rumors or say things to you? You always hear people saying, women in the military, they're either in there because they want to find a husband or because they're a lesbian. You know, either one extreme or the other. There's never any middle ground. Did you ever run into any of that? You know, any of those stereotypes? Did you ever hear any of those?
In World War II, there had never been so many women in the military.
Uh-huh.
And I know I've read and I've talked to General Hoisington, who was director of Women's Army Corps, about the fact that the men didn't want their daughters to serve because of all those rumors.
Uh-huh.
But that has changed over the years. What it is today, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I know in my time it certainly had changed. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had to get into the Waltford Army program. I think there were over 1,100 applicants. It's in this book, but uh-huh. I'm sure that's what you'll read it. They wouldn't have wanted to have served. So I think that in itself shows the change that occurred, you know, from the early days. Look at all the people, the women now who want to serve their country. It is true that they're getting bonuses and so forth. I'm now talking about the nun nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting bonus education, all those. And now she's married with children, maybe, you know, as far as any remuneration is concerned, this is a primary factor. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know the only problem that we're having as far as recruiting, from what I've read, and that is they've had to give bonuses for nurse anesthetists to come in, and sizable bonuses, maybe like $20,000 or $30,000, a lot of money to me. So it's much more than I made as a general officer in those days. But they're short in those specialties.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, I don't think they're short in anything. So why would these people be wanting to come into the service to be nurses if they would look down upon nurses? Now, women generally, why would all those people come in? Why would all those women go to West Point? They know they're going to serve in the Army. They have to serve 8 years at least after they graduate from West Point. Right? That may have changed, but it wasn't my time. They'd have to put in 8 years of service. By the time they get 8 years in, they think, oh my, you know, it's only 12 more years, I'll be put in 20. That's the today. And then they go out with nice pensions and they have all the raises. In fact, those people are making much more money than I ever made. But the thing is that in my time, it was 30 years, you see. And we had no compunction whatsoever of serving 30 years. I mean, that was wonderful, serving 30 years. Now I know that the majority of serve 20 years, and then they go on to take another position. Well, by the time you've served 30 years, and you go through 3 wars, I mean, it's you're pretty well done. But I did have several offers, of course, even to be an ANA, but I didn't. I felt it was so important. I had not been feeling well. I had cancer. I had my lung surgery. And, of course, then since that time, I've had cancer and various things. I'm just now getting over bronchitis again. Last year I had pneumonia. Last year I lost so many of my friends, 2 of my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law, put my sister in a nursing home. I mean, it's been horrendous year. This Christmas she had heart surgery. I mean, I spent my Christmas in the hospital this year. So, I mean, it's, you know, I just don't have any whatever it takes anymore. But I guess for 85, I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, I drive up to Pennsylvania and I'm, of course, given good nursing care. I still run a committee at Walter Reed. And I'm grateful that I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had a wonderful experience, and I'll tell you, if I could do the whole thing all over again. I've so often said it, and I say it again, I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have done anything else. I've had a wonderful career. I mean, zigzagging from one, I've worked in every clinical specialty, took care of very famous people. And yet, I've often said this, and I'll say it now, the very best patient was always the G.I. Joe. You know a G.I. Joe, what that means? Okay. The lowly enlisted man, you know, he's the one that's so important. It's my privilege to take care of him. And I think the nurses today feel the same way. I know they do. Those in Iraq, as well as those serving everywhere else. I don't know how many hospitals are even open today. I know they don't have 103. Because we've closed some of our biggest hospitals. And the rumor now is they're going to close the big hospital in Augusta, Georgia. So, no, because money's, you see, and they're going to close certain facilities. But yeah, the Army's changed. Therefore, the Army Medical Department has changed. Therefore, the Army Nurse Corps has changed. So, but we do have a greater ability to state our desires and so forth by being on equal level in the hospital situation, which wasn't in my time until we did so during my time, but prior to that time it wasn't. And I don't know if any other chief tried to change it, because sometimes you can only get so much in each period. You have to build on your previous chief and what she's done, and or he's done. We've had one male chief nurse, so what he's done, still done. And, I find it very difficult now if I were to be a chief nurse, because she not only has, our chief nurse, as you know, not only has the whole Far East and head of the Tripler Army Hospital Medical Center and chief of the Army Nurse Corps. Now, if she would have had all the responsibilities that I had, she couldn't do it. I know her responsibilities are, as far as the chief now, much of that has been out. Like personnel is no longer under the chief. It's way over there in the Alexandria. The Army Medical Center, all that is down in towards San Houston, Texas. So she doesn't have as much responsibility. But I still don't know how she's going to do the things that are important as chief. I told her the other day, I said, I don't see how. I said, one of the important things is for you to get around and let the nurses see you and talk with you. And that you get around to all the units, not just see the commanding officer, but to get out into where the nurses are. And not just make that one speech where you have everybody in the auditorium. That's not. She said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it or not. She said, I'll have to send my assistant. And I said, but that's not you. They want to see the chief. So as I say, I think it would be impossible for me to be chief, because I would be killing myself trying to do all the things that I think should be done. This chief that we have now seems to be very efficient, which is good.
Can you see the? I don't think you can. Have you been to the Vietnam Women's Memorial?
Vietnam Women's Memorial, of course.
What did you think about that?
Well, when it was first being constructed, when the plans were given, that the original statue, I disapproved of totally.
Just the single nurse.
The single nurse in that horrible uniform. I mean, it wasn't even the uniform that we wore in Vietnam.
The fatigues.
And so then I remember writing a big critique, and eventually everybody, you know, agreed, not just with me, but other people felt the same way, I'm sure. And then it was changed to the three individuals. I think it makes quite an impression on the civilians, the way it's portrayed, you know, but they don't know that. I had a friend from Florida just a couple of weeks ago saying they were over there, and they didn't know who was the nurse or who was what, or looking up at the sky. They didn't comprehend at all. But they did comprehend that holding the soldier, they did understand. But what upsets me about that statue, although I supported it wholeheartedly, is they don't have any insignia on. And if you take a good look at it, see, there's no nurse insignia. And the reason for that, they were trying to portray, as you probably know, all women in Vietnam. Well, when you talk about all women in Vietnam, practically everyone was a nurse. There were a few Red Cross nurses. There were a few line people down in, not up in the field, but down at headquarters. in finance or you know, some such job, stationary positions, and that's it. So I felt strongly that at least that the person holding the wounded soldier should have an end, and also that person looking up. You know what that signifies?
She's supposed to be waiting for the evac.
Yeah, she's waiting for the helicopter to come down, right? But she doesn't have an N on, don't you see? But I think it's a nice one, don't you?
I do. I do.
I think it's very nice.
Yeah.
And after all, this was recommended, as you probably know, by a reserve nurse. Mm-hmm. She felt that the women weren't being given enough recognition. And this girl who wrote, or was the one who did this book, was just about the second one who worked on that, and spent a lot of her own money, and worked tirelessly on that project. And there were several nurses who worked so hard to get that set. And they're still fighting. I think the last time we were trying to do something over there, to put better directions, you know, as they go along, and to put little plaques out, something about Army nurses, mm-hmm. and to get a better plaque there. And I don't think that's been done yet. And I know that this girl who did this book is just given up that now because she's getting older. You know, as you get older, you just can't do what you did. And but the person who started it, who started the project, is still with it. They're not getting enough money in now, though, you know, to have an office. Mm-hmm. So that makes it difficult. But you can't. It costs to have a secretary if people aren't contributing. It's just the same way with IMSA, you know. I don't know if it's true, but they're not getting as much money as they're going to need. Mm-hmm. They don't have as many people as they'd like to have working there. Rumors again. Mm-hmm. So you don't know what is true or what isn't. But I do know about the Women's Memorial. They're still working on it to even get it better, mm-hmm. as far as directions. And because a lot of people come and see Vietnam Memorial, which is wonderful, really. So touching. But they forget to get over there. And then the Korean Memorial. Don't you like that one?
Mm-hmm. I do.
I think that is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I can see those faces, and that's the way, you know, it was. You have to watch. You know, it's the same way in Iraq. You don't know who's your enemy or your friend. Mm-hmm. Same way in Korea. We didn't know the North Korean from the South Korean. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the North Vietnamese from the South Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. But I think that the sculpturist, was it a sculptor? Yeah. Did a tremendous job. Mm-hmm. And the man who developed that was named General Stilwell, no relation to General Stilwell from World War II. He wanted more figures, mm-hmm. but then they cut him down, and I think the number they have now is good. Mm-hmm. But you know, just before it was dedicated, after all the hours of work he done, he never saw it built. Never saw it dedicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's always some sadness, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there's so much protest about the Vietnam War Memorial?
I don't know if any.
Commission.
Oh, well, that's
turned down. And
their
editorial,
if you know,
the papers.
I know, but a lot of that was unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is just the way Washington works. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to go this commission and that commission, and all the way, I think there were five or six different approvals that they had to obtain. That's the way it is with everything. Mm-hmm. They were trying to build the Indian. That went through the same thing. Mm-hmm. Now they're trying, as you know, they're going to have one for Martin Luther King, or is it for blacks? But it's going to be right on the rim of the cherry, where the cherry blossoms. There's one place there, not too far from Roosevelt. Well, they're going through the same thing now. Mm-hmm. Because no more are allowed on the mall. So that's off the mall. So it's, have you seen Roosevelt?
Mm-hmm.
I think I like that one too. But it's always controversy.
Yeah. Yeah.
See? And actually, when I look upon it now, there wasn't as much controversy about the Women's Memorial as it is some of these others. Mm-hmm. So I would not make that a major issue. It's just Washington. Mm-hmm. And you'll never get everyone to be happy with anything. You know, right now you're reading the papers about the dissatisfaction with the Indian Museum. And 10 years from now, that won't be, you know. It'll either be fixed, you know, they'll do something about it, or it will remain as it is, and nobody will be complaining. Mm-hmm. It's just like, and I think as you get older, like I, you get more mellow and you understand why, you know, the why of things. And if everybody would have liked the original, I didn't know you knew about the wood statue because I didn't know too much was written about that. But, yeah, that was not so good. It wouldn't have been good. She was carrying a helmet. Looked as though it was a bowl of soup. Did you see it? You have pictures of it? Yeah. Okay. You really did. I've never seen a nurse carrying a helmet like that. Uh-huh. You see how wrong it was? Uh-huh. It just wasn't suitable.
Do you read much of it? There have been books that nurses have written. Do you read?
I have a whole pile of them in there, but I had chicken pox in my eye. Uh-huh. Would you believe it? Yeah. It's called the herpes zoster ophthalmicus. And that happened to me in 92, and I haven't read very much then, since then. And it's this period of time now that books are coming out. Like, I could have written a long time ago, but, you know, I have them. The last one that I received was If I Perish, If I Should Perish. Did you see that one? The authors were here interviewing me. They want to do some work. They're on another book now that's going to cover the Far East. So that will include where I was. In China and India, and so that's why they came, and they were here about a couple months ago. So I don't do too much reading, but they're there, mm-hmm. and I want to read them, but uh-huh. by the time I get finished with my newspapers and two other projects I'm working on, I am working on a lot of them. And like yesterday, I spent 3 hours going through this, and then I couldn't remember anything, and my eyes were so teary and tired and burning. So I have to be careful. I have a lot of scar tissue in this eye. What happened was this was my bad eye. I couldn't see anything in this room. And I was treated over at Fort Myer. Is this on tape? But anyway, yeah. So they thought I needed antibiotics. They thought it was just an infection, which it looked like. But had he been an ophthalmologist, he would have recognized it right away. So by the time I got to Walter Reed, the 2 week period had gone by. And if you don't get a certain drug, a Cyclovir, within 72 hours, can't have your vision. So I lost a lot of vision in this eye, the scar tissue, you know, your expert. And then I had my cataract removed over here, and unfortunately, the lasers they used later burned down into my macula, which is part of the retina, which means this vision is now worse than this vision. So I can't do much reading. I can drive, and I certainly know you, and I can read, but I just can't spend my day reading anymore. Yeah. And he can't do anything to improve my vision. So from here on, it will only be going down. And I had to go in for my license, or my car license the other day last week. And I took the eye exam, and she said, I'll let you try it once again. So I tried it the second time. She said, no. I said, oh, please, let me try it again. I said, I know I can read that. And so she let me try it again the third time, and I passed it. It's very simple. It's just one line. But you see, I just couldn't seem to say it. Mm-hmm. And I almost lost my license. And you know, that would have meant I'd have to move into an assisted living or a nursing home or something. Because without a car in the Washington area, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
So I was really, I think I'm still shaking from that experience last week.
Uh-huh. Did you hear anything about any of those books? You know, there have been several books by, in particular, Vietnam nurses.
Well, some of them were really off. Mm-hmm. And I just read, I showed it to the historical nurse, an article that was written by the Alliance Group. That's a group of women from all the military services and those people interested in women. Mm-hmm. And they published a paper, a little newsletter every month. And someone who claims to have been in the CBI where I was, and they talk about a certain instance. She was so far off that I don't even think she would ever even visit our area. Because remember, I told you we were, what I thought, 1,000 miles above Calcutta. She was stationed in a hospital 1,000 miles below us. And yet she's explaining about our casualties and everything up north. Couldn't possibly be. Uh-huh. Saying there were over 200 nurses killed. Well, even you know that. You're not even a nurse, right? And you're not a nurse corps. So wrong. And yet it was published. Uh-huh. And so you have to look at most of those that are coming out that are by one author, you know, there's no substantiation. There's no research. It's bad. And even with this book, you know, in here, for instance, this nurse took everything that's written about me. She had one interview with me, which wasn't very long, and one telephone call, I think. But she didn't know everything, but then she couldn't possibly put everything in one little article, and it had so many words. But I'm sure that these nurses, now the ones who wrote If I Perish, I do want to read that one shortly. I just finished another book I had to read, and so I'll get into that one now. But I heard nothing but good remarks about that. I have heard some bad comments on some of the others. But just that one article that I read about this nurse saying that we lost over 200 nurses. It's just not true. And yet, see, there's no one to say that's true. Well, I tried my best by notifying the historical nurse, but it's too late. It's been published, and this went on to some fantastic things that she did. Impossible. Say, I know. Impossible. Yeah. I was there.
Yeah.
I may only have been a second lieutenant, but I knew what was going on. It wasn't derogatory, but I mean, it wasn't true. So these other books could well be the same, or they could be very good. I don't know. I don't know.
You said at the beginning that there were some. I'm not sure what you were referring to. That's why I want to ask you again. That some of the things either written about nursing in Vietnam made you mad.
Did
there
I say that?
Something.
I don't
there
think
was something.
I said mad. I don't use the word mad.
Okay. Maybe not. So maybe it wasn't even mad. Did you see?
Did I say they disturbed me? But I don't know. Anything written about nurses that disturbed me. I don't know.
Okay. Maybe I'm making up something. I don't know.
I have to get back into what we were talking about.
Okay. Maybe I'm thinking different things. Who knows? Did you ever see that show about nurses in Vietnam, the China Beach show that was on? Did you ever watch that?
No, I met the actress. Mm-hmm. What was her name?
Dana Delaney?
No. Something else. No, I didn't see it.
Uh-huh.
No.
Okay.
That was on, I can't comment it because I didn't see it.
Uh-huh.
But I think most people like that. I think they like that.
A lot of people did, yeah.
I think that was taken at where our 6th Convalescent Hospital was on. Where the President Johnson had his White House over there in Vietnam. And I can't think of the name right now. But can you think of the name?
I'm trying to think.
And then it was called China Beach, but it was...
It's not Bung Tao.
No, not Bung Tao. No, it's south. It's south, but some Bung Tao is real south. Mm-hmm. It was maybe 50 miles above Saigon. Well, that on my dresser, or not on my dresser, my commode, that was given to me by the nurses at the 6th Convalescent Center, and that's where China Beach was. And it might be on that, so.
Uh-huh.
But in Long Bing, but not too far from Long Bing. I don't know how you remember that. Why do you ask me if I saw South Beach or whatever it's called?
China Beach. No, I just wonder. I always ask, there's certain things I always ask everybody because everybody has different opinions. So it's just interesting to hear everybody's different opinions about the China Beach or about the memorial or, the books. There's Home Before Morning.
Home Before Morning, yeah.
Different ones.
Yeah.
There's just certain things I always ask.
Younger nurse would probably be more aware of those books than I, because they're just not coming out.
Uh-huh.
And those two people who served in Vietnam would really want to get to them and see.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if I had left China, Burma, India, and I'd want to get back and see what they're writing about China, Burma, India.
Yeah.
But I just sort of put them away because right now I had other priorities.
Uh-huh.
With my family, with myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had a knee replaced 4 years ago. I stumbled on this top step.
Mm-hmm.
So if my maid or the girl who works with me wasn't here, I had taken her tray because I was so afraid she was going to spill it. I shouldn't have taken it. Because when I got to the top step, oh, I don't know why this leg just didn't, you know, go up to the next step and I stumbled and I broke the leg and the ankle and tore the cartilage in this leg and my knee. And so I had to have this knee replaced. It's been over 2 years now. Doing very well. But I've had one thing after another since I retired. And then, of course, I bought a home over in Spain. I had a beautiful mansion over there, really. I couldn't afford it now. So I've enjoyed my life, tried to enjoy my life. And I serve on boards here and then go back to Spain and just go back and forth.
Are you still going back to Spain?
No, I sold it in 86. I wish I had still had it. I couldn't afford it. I couldn't buy it back now. I was going away for over $1 million. Couldn't begin to afford that. It's enough to have this place. But the reason I gave up, I thought I was getting old at 86, so then I would have been, how old, 66, and I thought, I'm too old to travel, you know. Here I'm still living. But to keep this place going and that place, and I had a gardener 5 days a week, so, you know, of course, it didn't cost much over there. But you can imagine the beautiful place I had. It was really gorgeous. Yeah, I still send Christmas presents to the maid and to my gardener. They don't have much. As I said, I've had a wonderful life.
Yeah, and you retired at 30 years, 71.
Yeah, I was 51 years of age. The Army's been good to me. Very good. But I never dreamed, you know, this would happen to me. Just impossible. Been very fortunate.
Did it ever kind of hit you along the way that I might end up being chief? Or?
I never thought about being chief. Even when I was assistant chief, as I said, I wanted to be chief nurse of the hospital. That was my desire. And when they sent me to school for my master's, I didn't know what they were going to do with me, but I thought, you know, maybe I thought to myself, maybe I'm going to be chief of Walter Reed. So I was very happy to be chief of the Corps, but I never expected it. I never expected to be assistant chief. So I was just fortunate. I always say, if you're prepared, and I must say I felt when I was giving nursing care that I always did my best. And I suppose it was noted, taking care of the presidents. That sort of helped,
heard
I'm sure.
Anything.
But I've had such tremendous experiences along the way. And I never dreamed of being assistant chief, let alone chief. But I was disappointed I never became chief of Walter Reed. Yeah, that was a disappointment. If they had told me that I could have been reduced in grade to a colonel for a certain period of time and gone back and become chief, I would have done it. One of our former chiefs did that. She was a full colonel, and she had a couple years left before her 30 years, the way I understand it. And so then she went back and became chief nurse of Europe as a lieutenant colonel, Colonel Bryan. And then when she finished that tour, she went back to her full grade of colonel.
Wow.
But that wasn't to be, and as a general officer, couldn't do that. So.
And what exactly was the difference between a general officer and another officer? You know, when you say you're promoted to general, but that it's a general officer rank. What does that mean? As opposed to, you know, why weren't you a general officer as even a lieutenant or a major or captain or whatever?
Well, you see, as
for the non-military person.
Yeah, right, for a non-military person, as I mentioned, the Army has so many generals that Congress decides how many general officers they're going to have. Every person who's promoted to general has to be approved by Congress,
right?
Same. And then goes up, you know, first it goes, my promotion to be approved by the Department of the Army, DOD, Congress, signed by the President. Okay? So if I'm lieutenant colonel or colonel, none of that is necessary.
Right.
It has to be through promotion, it's through the Department of the Army. But there again, DOD decides, and Congress actually decides, the structure, they'll say, you're going to have so many Army soldiers, you're going to have so many Army officers, say, and then it's broken down into grades. So whether they're second lieutenants, captains, majors, or colonels, or lieutenant colonels. But when you become a general officer, you're always a general officer, you know. And the difference is you're supposed to be prepared to do any job.
Okay.
So, but they're generally not going to take a nurse. Yeah. But they're generally not going to take a professional nurse, say, and put her in charge of artillery, you see.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is that I'm able to lead, or I'm supposed to be able to lead, uh-huh. and to organize, you see,
okay.
because I'm a general officer. And, well, that's expected of everyone, you know, to lead in their, wherever they are. Uh-huh. But when you become a general officer, you generally, in the old days, you take away your N and you have another insignia, which means you're a general officer, so you're able to just lead any troops anywhere. But that's more or less fiction because it's not done, per se.
Okay.
And the chief of the Army Nurse Corps now still wears her nurse insignia, you see, even though she's a general officer. So you wear the star of a general officer, but you wear your nurse corps.
Okay.
But a graduate of West Point, now say a graduate of West Point, when she becomes there, he becomes a general officer, he's supposed to be prepared to work in any area, whether it's infantry, artillery, or whatever, but they generally don't do that because it would be foolish, wouldn't it? If somebody is prepared to be an infantry officer, has gone through school, different schools that they have to prepare them as an infantry officer, and then make them Surgeon General. I mean, it's
right.
an impossible
right.
thing. See?
Okay.
So when you look at it, you just know that a general officer is a different grade structure, and the one star is the lowest, and the two stars, three stars, four stars. And I see in the future there will be a four-star female. As I said, I hope it's going to be a West Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be, of course. But it would be nice to be, because it's not going to be a nurse. See, they're not going, because the Surgeon General is only a three-star. And that three-star came just because it was Surgeon General Heaton, and because President Eisenhower made it possible before our Surgeon General was a two-star.
A nurse couldn't be above her.
No, of course not.
Who's above her?
No, of course not.
Uh-huh.
See? So okay. sometimes people talk about things and they don't know really what they're talking about.
Yeah, I knew that there was it was a big deal. This general officer.
Right.
I wanted to get, you know,
supposed to lead
be clarified.
The troops.
Okay.
Supposed to be able to lead the troops and to manage them.
Okay.
That's a big sample.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The only difference, I tease about it, but I was chief of the Corps, I was made a general officer, went to what we call charm school, you know, they orient general officers.
Uh-huh.
And I had no difference in responsibility because I was so busy. But I did get one perk, and that was a parking space. So before I was a general officer, I didn't have that parking space because
uh-huh.
we were so short of parking spaces.
Uh-huh.
But once I became a general, I got a parking space. Well, I was very happy for that. Yes, because before I had to take the bus, don't you see,
uh-huh.
into the Surgeon General's office.
Uh-huh.
And that was really a joke, though, because I was able to park, but I really didn't have a specific space that I was to use.
Uh-huh.
But when I was assistant chief, in the early days of chief, I took a bus in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had our building where you have the Vietnam Memorial,
mm-hmm.
just down on the Constitution Avenue, mm-hmm. all torn down now. You know, the lake is there.
Uh-huh.
That's where our building was. And then we moved to the Forestville Building, which is on Independence Avenue. And there were more spaces there. But we didn't have a designated space. Well, once you get a general officer, you know, it would be a reserved space. So it's good. Yeah. So I always tease, and they
uh-huh.
say, well, what's the difference? I'd say, well, I got a parking space.
Uh-huh.
But not, it's sort of exaggeration, but still the truth.
Yeah.
It's still the truth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And more money.
Mm-hmm.
The pay was increased.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about that, though, too much.
Did it ever really hit you? You're now, I mean, did all, because people for hundreds of years are going to write about General Anna May Hayes, first woman general, you know.
Yeah.
Does any of that ever hit you?
No, not
or
really.
Not?
No, I don't. I look upon my job as chief of the Army Nurse Corps.
That first.
That first, you know. And then serving my country as a general officer was just something I never expected. The Nurse Corps never expected it, don't you see? But things change. As I say, someday there will be a four-star.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way our society goes. We're ever changing, which is good. We have to be dynamic. If we stand still, we'd never get anywhere. And that's why I used to tell the nurses, if you don't have education and research, you know, if you're just standing still and you're not doing anything to prepare for what you have to do, you're losing out. You just lost everything that you gained. And so I always feel if you're prepared and you're at the right place at the right time and you know the right people, I know one of the biographies, autobiography really, written by one of my succeeding chiefs, talks about going to the Pentagon and seeing all the generals and all that stuff, and that's why she became a general. Don't quote me, but it couldn't possibly be true, you know? She didn't become a general officer because she went over there and told him that she thought he'd be a general. I mean, so you have to, whenever, you know, whatever is written, you have to realize, you know, some of it may not be quite true, but you try to be honest. I mean, everyone who does that tries to be honest, but still there are little things that aren't quite so, not quite so honest. But it was a privilege, you know. Yeah, I should have written a book a long time ago, I know, but a lot of things. I grew up, you know, as a Salvation Army family, so I was exposed as a youngster to a lot of responsibility. You know, I had a Girl Scout troop when I was young. It was during the Depression. I taught kids how to play the piano, charged them 10 cents, and then with that I could contribute toward my lessons. To stand on the street corners, you know, with the other Salvationists. Sunday we'd all go to the jail to preach, you know, to sing and preach to the people in jail. So I grew up assuming a lot of responsibility. Played for church services on the piano. When I was in Korea, I used to play the pump organ out in the field, you know. So I used to do the same thing at Chinatown Indian Theater. Mm-hmm. I had a little pump organ. I used to play for all the churches, whether Catholic or Protestant, it didn't matter. Yeah. You know, I just played the organ. But, I grew up having a lot of responsibility. My mother and father were equated. You know, my father had rank, and my mother had rank. So you see, I never saw a difference that they were putting or diminishing my mother in any way. They were equal. Mm-hmm. So I grew up men, women, equal. I never thought of anything else. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course, but I still didn't think I would ever become an Army nurse. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm growing up, mm-hmm. my mother and father thought I was going to be a missionary over in India. It's ironic, isn't it?
You got to India.
You know, but I was. I know that they've told me that, you know, mm-hmm. often, well, you're going to be a missionary nurse. I know it because that's the way you are. Well, I don't know how I was, but but so when you have responsibility, it's to me, you just do it, don't you? I mean, if you have something, if you want to finish your dissertation, you're going to do it. And if you don't want to do it, you're not a doctor. You don't have your doctorate. And that's what used to irritate me when we'd send someone to school to get a doctorate and they wouldn't write their dissertation. You know, something else would come up and they would put it off, then they never got it written. And that wasn't right. See, because they used monies that could have been spent on someone else. And but that's life again. Well, can you think of anything else?
I think we've covered everything.
Well, if you misunderstand anything, you certainly aren't going to use much space on me. This is going to be on nurses in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But if there's any question, you know, just give me a call.
Yeah, I'll go through this and transcribe it and send you a copy too, and that way you'll have it. If there's stuff that
really far off,
I don't understand or
right. Of course, that takes time, but I'll try to do it.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have too much on me, please. Concentrate. And that's why I want you to get to people like, you know, Colonel Southby. Mm-hmm. And I'm so sorry that the nurse who was the first chief nurse of the 8055, that unit, mm-hmm. just has beginning Alzheimer's, just beginning, and she's just this year been moved back to Massachusetts or somewhere in the Northeast to go, I think, into an Alzheimer's unit. Not sure on that, just which unit, but to be near her family. Uh-huh. And this is why I'm saying some of the nurses who are older, they never know what's going to happen. My very erudite, see, I started in the office having not just an assistant, chief. I mentioned this. But I also had an assistant to the chief. Mm-hmm. And then I had another person in there, mm-hmm. and who became the first chief nurse of the MUST unit. Mm-hmm. And that unit, by the way, was bombed over in Vietnam, and the commanding officer was killed. So all those, it was